It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Hot diggity, here we go again, the second day of May. If I remember to play the green news later this evening and you hear Brad Friedman say it's the second day of March, disregard that. The content in the green news report is current. Brad just isn't. It's the second day of May 2019. This is The Horn. Headon.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. And that's also where you find the link that says chat room. And if you click on that and pick yourself out a screen name and a password, jump in, you'll be immediately greeted by early arrivers Otto and Squeaky. You'll also be capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has folded space this afternoon to become Man Cave, and also there moderating away is pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all around great guy Steve from Georgistan. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and we've got a nice little handful of ouchies to work with this evening. Also, getting the program started, new month, new fundraising, and so consequently, there's a 200, well, there's no challenges on the table, nothing. We did meet Shirley's challenge yesterday, so that means that, well, there's 200 bucks to be raised this evening. 10 at 20, 20 at 10, 1 at 200, 2 at 100, 4 at 50, 8 at 25, etc. But there's 200 bucks to be raised. The contribute tab at headon.live works real good-like, and you'll also find on the website there the mailing address for those of you who prefer to operate via the U.S. mail. Thanks going out to our good friend of longstanding friends, Brandon and Fennell in Brooklyn, for jumping in via the mails. And also thanks to Jude in the Great Northwest. Jude likes to participate via the mails. And thanks go out to other subscribers, for our subscribers for the second day of the month. Thank you very, very kindly indeed, because we begin the program with gratitude every day. Thank you very much indeed to Rocco and Dave. Thank you to Elizabeth, and thank you to Reggie. Thank you all very, very much. Our subscribers, someday, you know, maybe there'll be 400 of them, and we won't waste time talking, but no, but our subscribers knock out a full week of our fundraising needs over the course of a month, and so thank you very much. It is, as I said, Thorn in the Side Thursday. We do have a full plate, and, poltroon pullet news to talk about today, because, of course, Bill Barr is a coward who is afraid to face afraid to face questioning from anyone who won't provide him cover. He got his ass handed to him yesterday in the Senate and may have actually, well, from the looks of things, he may have committed two or three counts of perjury. And that's not a good thing for the nation's so-called top cop to be doing. But nonetheless, but then again, you'd have to refer him to the Justice Department for prosecution for perjury. And, well, when the top cop that runs the Justice Department gets charged with perjury, all he has to do is say, nah, I didn't. I find that I didn't. Right. And, hey, good technical news. Both the HeadOn.live, which always works, and the White Rose stream is banging along happily. So all the little streams are working this evening. So thank you very kindly, Jack and Shreveport and Brother Deacon Asa, for letting me know that. There's a sense of relief that accompanies having things work the way they're supposed to. But since we don't have any chicken bill, yeah, the pullet, the poltroon pullet. Pullet's another word for chicken, but you know that. Since we don't have anything along those lines really to talk about, we can look at some other acts of Republican skullduggery and scumminess and sleaziness and skeeviness. For instance, we can travel down to Nash Vegas, you know, capital of the state of Tennessee, where they have themselves a Speaker of the House by the name of Glenn Quesada. Yes, yes, he does sound rather like an overripe melon, or perhaps a valley, a glen, you know, in Scott's parlance. A glen is kind of a valley, otherwise known as the holler. The place where the Quesadas grow. No, I don't know. Anyway, whatever House Speaker of Tennessee, Glenn Quesada is, otherwise, he's a dick. A jerk. Get this. He's so petty and such a pissant that he took legal action against, and you know, remember, the Republicans are the ones that are such awesome Christians of awesomeness. The Speaker of the Tennessee House took legal action against a divinity student from Vanderbilt University, a guy by the name of Justin Jones. News Channel 5 there in Nashville looked into the matter, and it turns out the chief of staff of Speaker Glenn Quesada may have Bill Barred, that's another word now for lying, just because Glenn Quesada was scared of the little Vanderbilt divinity student. It's a little complicated, but not terribly. Just weird for the most part. Glenn Quesada replaced a House Speaker, also another Republican, in Tennessee by the name of Beth Harwell. And Beth Harwell, while she didn't give a fuck about their concerns, because after all, MAGA, y'all, she would at least listen to the students and take a meeting with them and say things like, bless your heart, yes, God love you, and send them along the way. Well, Glenn Quesada has taken over as Speaker of the Tennessee House, and those are things up with which he will not put, like protesting for voting rights. Well, Glenn Quesada's not a big fan of voting rights, especially if the wrong coloreds are doing the voting. And he also is a big fan of a Confederate general whose statue stands on the State House grounds there in Nash Vegas. Justin Jones, the Vanderbilt Divinity student, described these Republican thugs in the tennis stand house as a mean group. He says, you see a sort of drunkenness with power. There's an extremism that's happening. So here's what happens. When some protests took place, at one point, a cup was tossed into the speaker's elevator. This was back in February. And lo and behold, there was the long arm of the law to arrest, let me emphasize this, divinity student, Justin Jones, for assault. So then Glenn Quesada said that if he promised to have no contact, or the court said that if Jones promised to have no contact with Quesada, that he'd be released without any charges. This, Justin Jones obeyed. He said, this much later, I've still not had any contact with Quesada, and have not been at the Capitol, so I followed the no-contact order. Well, that really doesn't matter. Because a district attorney general by the name of Glenn Funk, I don't put the names in the stories, I just deal with the stories as they arise. Yes, Glenn Funk, in early March, because I guess all the other things that an assistant district attorney general, or maybe Nashville DA, has to do, I guess there's no crime left in Nashville because Glenn Funk filed a motion to revoke Justin Jones's bail. He said he said that Justin Jones sent a threatening email to Quesada's chief of staff, and he copied the House Speaker, and that violated his bond. Well, you remember yesterday during the bar hearings, when the pullet poltroon Chicken Bill said that he hadn't actually looked at any of the evidence before he made a conclusion about whether or not there was any criminal liability that attached to the chlamydia Claudius. Well, this is a little bit like that. Because the DA in the case filed the motion to revoke bail based on a photograph of an email. And the photograph of the email was dated March 1st. Here's the problem. That was the date of the photograph, not the date of the email. The email was written February 25th. Before Justin Jones was ever arrested. And when the heat began to rise beneath the feet of big, bad, tough lawman Glenn Funky in Nash Vegas, he went, "Well, that's not our fault. It ain't our fault. We didn't... The Speaker's chief of staff done gibbed us that photo, and he's the one what said it violated the bond, and we's just doing what we's told because we's all Republicans here." Oh, that's quite good. Randy in PA asking of Glenn Quesada, is he a Manchurian cantaloupe like our fearless leader? Oh, wait. Manchurian cantaloupe. I like it. But when they began to complain, turned out Justin Jones was guilty of precisely nothing. Well, the DA started running away. Justin Jones said it was done to put me in jail, which is scary that somebody in such a public office, an office that swears to uphold the state constitution, an office that is in charge of a $38 billion budget, is doing something like this. I mean, it's shameful. Yeah. The speaker's office really, really hates it. No, not because it was wrong or sleazy or filthy or anything. Because they got caught. And the district attorney, the Glenn Funk, has funk all over his face because he went along with the scam. And Glenn Quesada, meanwhile, says, "I don't know nothing about no incident. You need to talk to my chief of staff." Then, in turn, the chief of staff, the chief of staff is not returning calls. You understand? That would be Cade Cothran. And by the way, in trying to seek what the speaker's position was on that Confederate general, it's not just any Confederate general. It's a really disgusting Confederate general, as if there was any other kind. Although some did go on to rehabilitate themselves at least a little bit. But in this case, it's Nathan Bedford Forrest. Yes, the state of Tennessee has a statue to Nathan Bedford Forrest, the father of the Klan. No, really. And the speaker doesn't want to get rid of it. Imagine being, I mean, wow. Yeah, the email that almost sent Justin Jones to jail read as follows. "I'm writing on behalf of our student coalition as you recommended to once again follow up about the confirmed date and time for our meeting with Speaker Quesada. Again, we're seeking to discuss the speaker's position on the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue in the Tennessee Capitol and voting rights legislation that would allow students to use our school IDs to vote like most other states with voter identification requirements. Last week, you said you didn't receive these emails because Capitol was misspelled. That was untrue." No, really. He claimed, yeah. He goes on and says, "I'm willing to acknowledge it as an oversight on your part." This apparently pissed off Cade Cothran. And then Cade Cothran, there was a text exchange between the Tennessee Speaker of the House and his chief of staff. Yeah. Apparently they're really candid with each other when they text. I don't know who they're talking about, but the exchange goes like this. "Wow, I'm starting to like him." And background on this, they had deployed field operatives to various districts. Yeah. Well, I'm starting to like him, says Glenn Quesada. If he just would have left Common Core alone. Cade Cothran responds, black people are idiots. And so is anyone that loves Common Core. It's killing our children. It's not clear. I mean, you know, Cade Cothran, black people are idiots. Cade Cothran, and so is anyone who loves Common Core. Cade Cothran, it's killing our children. And whoever was the respondent, and I don't think it was Glenn Quesada, said, literally murdering them by making them smarter. By the way, Cade Cothran and Glenn Quesada, neither one have responded, even though offered an opportunity to do so. So, just remember, yeah, the nitwit Nero is in the White House. His hand-picked criminal AG is in the Department of Justice. But there's a lot of this shit going on out in the wider world. There's a the texts just go on and on. Remember, and this is interesting because remember yesterday, Lindsey Graham just waxed so eloquent over the fact that Peter Strzok and that Lisa Page talked. They said ugly things about Donald Trump. Well, here's some good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexual Republicans from Tennessee saying things that are a lot uglier than I can smell the Trump support. Because there's another text exchange from Cade Cothran referring to, I guess, another political candidate. Someone texts and says, Mariotta against Winston. Yes, I want to see every second of that. Cade Cothran, the chief of staff to the Tennessee Speaker of the House, responds, don't say that name here. Call him Thug Ginger if you're going to say it, only he doesn't use the word ginger. He uses the other word that has the same letters in a different arrangement. Yeah. That's just Tennistan, and, you know, it's just a day that ends in Y. So from there, let's bebop back up here to West Virginia. This story, too, has a little bit of a past. It's the story of a little developmentally disabled girl. Literally, little girl. I mentioned this at the time when it broke, I think. She went to school in a special education classroom at Berkeley Heights Elementary School in Berkeley County, West Virginia, which is up in the considerably more affluent eastern panhandle area of this state. We're not talking about down in the Sacrifice Zone. We're talking about, you know, bedroom commuter communities to Washington, D.C. And a little girl got worried, or her mama got worried, because she would come home with bruises. Because she was autistic and nonverbal, she could not explain what had happened to her. That's when Mama tucked a little bitty voice recorder in her daughter's hair and sent her to school. And when her daughter came home, she played back the recording, and she heard things from school employees in the classroom, like, "I ought to backhand you in the teeth. How's that for anxiety?" Because they had been informed that the little autistic girl suffered from anxiety. "I ought to backhand you right in the teeth. How's that for anxiety?" And there was also on the recording, you could hear one of the educators say, "I'm going to pull your hair until you start crying." Or, "You're like a pygmy. You're like a pygmy thing." Or, "I'm going to beat your butt for sure." And Owen, another student in the special ed class, "You're going to get one just cause." And then straight up, "I'm going to knock you out." Mama was obviously and justifiably horrified. She took her kid out of that school the very next day. But then she did what I think any parent would do. By the way, West Virginia is a single consent state, which means you can be, as long as one of the parties consents, you can record, and the other party doesn't have to know. Where it gets a little weird, though, is the fact that it's a 5-year-old little girl, and she really wasn't capable of manifesting consent any more than she was capable of telling which of those educators had said they were going to knock her out or had left the bruises on her. Well, okay. So Mama took the recording to the police. The police listened to it and said, "Yeah, well, it don't sound like there's nothing on there we could take any action on." And even though they couldn't, this really does sound like it came out of Bill Barr's office, a cop went running to the school to talk to the principal. And so then on October 11th, like I said, this is months back, the superintendent of Berkeley County Schools got a copy of the recording. And eventually they did something because they took it took between October 11th and November 2nd, and the classroom workers, the teachers, remained in that classroom until November 2nd. Remember, there was one child in there that they had threatened to hit just 'cause. And so now the children's parents have banded together and they're suing the teachers, the school, and the board on a theory of negligent hiring and retention of these teachers. And they are suing as their children's next friends for the emotional harm done to the children. Meanwhile, the teachers have lawyers paid for them. And the defense lawyers have moved to exclude the recording from the court. There's no ruling, though, yet. But here's where it gets disgusting. The Board of Education of Berkeley County, West Virginia, has sued the parent who put the recording device in her daughter's hair so she could understand why her baby was so afraid to go to school. Amber Pack is the mama, and they've sued her for violating West Virginia's wiretap law. And so it will be decided by a judge. Later information suggested that the Board of Education's lawsuit had against Amber Pack had been dropped, but not before they filed it. It just simply would never have existed had they not filed it. But they did. So that means that somewhere in the halls of the Berkeley County, West Virginia Board of Education, there's somebody who thinks it's a good idea to retaliate against the mother of an autistic child who has been threatened and apparently beaten inside a classroom. Jesus God. No. You know, we're not a shitty, we're not a shithole country right now because of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is president because we've got some serious shithole problems in our country. For real. But for every story like that, there's a story that... wait a second. Let's check some email out real quick. I knew as soon as the Tennessee story came up with Glenn Funk, somebody would have to chime in. And the somebody who chimed in was Lady B, who said, "But Bob, we want the funk. Gotta have that funk." Ow! We want the funk. Yeah. What's that? Dave in Talibandiana. "I'm seeing a pattern here. Republicans don't want to get blamed for everything, but blame everything on everybody else, even when they do dirt. As far as Glenn Funk, I'm reminded of the quote, 'He thunk, therefore he no longer is.'" No, not funk. Funk. Yeah. And what's that? Ginger asks Lee in New York, "Are you telling me that if we call Ed Sheeran a ginger, I'm racist?" Well, it was... why is his name not immediately to hand? The guy who gave us... White Wine in the Sun, Australian artist, who said in a song, "Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger." Ginger? Are you telling me that if I call Ed Sheeran a ginger, I'm racist? I know it's an anagram of a racist word. Now I have to worry about what letters I get when I play Scrabble? Yes, you do! Unless you're playing Dirty Scrabble or something. Dirty Scrabble, by the way, is fun. It's almost as fun as Naked Radio. Which, with the studio at 77 degrees, I can promise you we're engaging in this evening. Well, I mean, we're not. I am. I don't know what you're doing. "I guess I have to play solitaire," says Lee. "Thanks for taking Scrabble out of my life, Bob." Well, sorry. These things happen. Jack in Shreveport, the case of the autistic child. "Wouldn't the parent be guilty of child endangerment or something if she had not done anything?" Absolutely. And so that's why she immediately did not let the child go back into the classroom with those monsters. Flavio was the autistic child. Were the parents black and were the instructors white? No. It was actually the opposite, or some mixture of the two. And Ron in Raleigh says, dare I suggest, could the person that filed that suit be, wait for it, a Republican? I almost guarantee it. I would not put money in the opposite direction. Oh dear, I've started something with the ginger business. Monique wants to know, so what do you call the redhead on Gilligan's Island? Ginger. Mm-hmm. On and on and on it goes. By the way, some more fun and interesting news. This is the happy part of the program. Or at least the somewhat more fun part of the program. Remember Don Blankenship? Now, the guy who pled guilty to a misdemeanor of dummying up mine safety regulations that resulted in 29 human beings being incinerated past recognition as having ever been human beings at the Upper Big Branch disaster years back? Yeah, that Don Blankenship. Well, Don, you might recall, was a Republican candidate in the Republican primary for Senate last year. And he came in pretty much third in a field of three. Pill Push and Patty Morrissey, the Attorney General of West Virginia. More on him in a moment. More on him. Moran him. Him Moran. Came in first, and then Evan Jenkins, who used to be my Congress critter and isn't anything anymore because he wasn't happy being a member of the House. He wanted to be a senator. Yeah, he came in second, and Don Blankenship came in third and then tried to run a third-party campaign and was stopped by the Supreme Court of the state of West Virginia. Well, Don's one of those people who has more dollars than cents. And so he has filed a suit against 75 news organizations. He filed it down in Mingo County, West Virginia, because I guess he owns property there yet. Doesn't really much live there. You might recall he had to get permission to go back and forth to his little mansion in Las Vegas back when he was being tried. Because remember, it's only a misdemeanor to get miners incinerated. It's a felony to rip off shareholders. And he was acquitted on the ripping off shareholders felony, but he was stone cold busted and the conviction stood in terms of the screwing around with the safety of people until 29 people got burned alive. Well, he's come up with a novel legal theory called weaponized defamation. In this goofball case that he filed down in what was back at the beginning of the 20th century referred to as Bloody Mingo. My great-grandfather started his family, he and my great-grandmother, down in Bloody Mingo. And because it was Bloody Mingo, they got on out of there and came on up to this county, where he survived to be beloved of my father. And we sort of keep his we keep Paw Davis in we keep his eternity alive by remembering him. That's how eternity works, I'm pretty much sure. But yeah, 75 news agencies. Weaponized defamation. And what he says in his lawsuit that he said he didn't lose because more people wanted Pill Push and Patty Morrissey, and more people wanted Evan Jenkins. He says he lost because he was referred to as a felon in what he describes as, because everybody in this law, whether it's Blankenship or, if there was some way where because he blames chinless Mitch McConnell for what he calls an orchestrated campaign against him, Don Blankenship. He also blames the Washington, D.C. establishment. I don't exactly know how you get good service of process on the D.C. establishment, but we'll leave that up to his lawyers. He is a convicted criminal. Convicted of a misdemeanor. He is not a convicted felon, to be clear. But here's what his lawsuit says. So too is the establishment media's bloodthirsty desire to destroy those with whom they disagree politically. We live in an age of weaponized defamation where lies can be repeated in more ways at more times in more places with more speed than anyone could possibly have imagined even 5 years ago, much less 1964 when the seminal case in the areas of defamation of public figures was decided. Yeah. Here's the best part. One of those members of the D.C. establishment being sued in this this goofball pleading is none other than the guy who was too stupid to indict. That's right, Donald Trump Jr. Yeah. It's 7 pages into the lawsuit before you get to this part. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted that Mr. Blankenship was a felon after meeting with and as part of a scheme with the National Republican senatorial campaign leadership seeking to prevent Mr. Blankenship's victory in the primary. You know what prevented Mr. Blankenship's victory in the primary? The number of votes that Mr. Blankenship didn't get. So I'm hard pressed to find somebody to. I mean, okay, so you root for the news agencies, okay? Sure. But, well, they're going to be okay. On the other hand, it would be nice if this thing wasn't dismissed for a little while so that Don could have a chance to explain to Merca just how dirty Mitch McConnell is. Mm-hmm. And here's the weird part. He sort of claims that the Republicans, and see if this sounds like anything you've ever heard of any Republican doing. He says the Republicans conspired to make sure that Joe Manchin won the election. Now, maybe Don didn't see all the coverage because maybe he was off in Las Vegas or somewhere, or maybe swanning around the French Riviera or something. But the ads that were run against Joe Manchin in this state were scurrilous. In other words, they were the typical Republican swill that happens at the time of any election. And in case you were wondering, even tiptoeing up this close to defending Joe Manchin has mandated that I engage in probably about 750 milliliters of brain bleach after this program is over. But there it is. Pill-pushing Patrick Morrissey protected Joe Manchin. Now, if it weren't for the fact that Don Blankenship is fabulously wealthy, people who spout that kind of crazy, they usually come after those folks with a butterfly net. But not Don Blankenship. And by the way, his lawsuit suggests that Uday, that would be Don Jr., is a surrogate for Mitch McConnell. There has been no word of response from Elaine Chao, who is married to the aforementioned McConnell. Sumon's having a little trouble with things. Orchestrated campaign? Help me understand, Bob. Wait a minute. Sumon definitely gets a cowbell for this one. Help me understand, Bob. If it's not orchestrated, how can it be a campaign? Oh, the art of word knowing is strong with Sumon. Yes, indeed. But I guess Blankenship's lawyers, just like the Nijinskys who were representing Donald Trump and the Trump grift universe against Deutsche Bank and Capital One, who's in your pocket? Well, they're billing by the hour, and they'll say any crazy goddamn thing that Don Blankenship wants to them, within reason, as long as the check keeps clearing. And along the way, the suit's new, so we don't have a response from Chinless Mitch. No. On the other hand, a minute ago, I said more to come regarding Pill Push and Patty Morrissey. Pill Push and Patty has, through Governor Jim Justice, the ironically named Jim Justice, a settlement. The state of West Virginia has come to a settlement with a drug company by the name of McKesson. And McKesson is one of those pill mills that helped set this state on fire with opioids over the last several years. Among other things, McKesson is one of the single largest distributors of prescription meds in the country. Just as a for instance, back in 2018, oh so long ago, they had annual revenue of $208.4 billion, otherwise known as $0.2 trillion, $0.2084 trillion, 20% of $1 trillion. Big money, right? Yeah. So McKesson has settled with the state of West Virginia for having taken God knows how many lives, ruined God knows how many others, overburdened the medical and addiction treatment facilities of this state past the breaking point, and, well, Pill Push and Patty Morrissey negotiated it. Remember, Pill Push and Patty Morrissey and his wife used to be lobbyists for the opioid industry. And if you're familiar with West Virginia, this kind of story doesn't shock you. I mean, this is, after all, the same state that once settled pollution violations with a coal company by telling them that they could pay off the settlement money, Flintstones-like, in rocks. I'm not kidding. It happened. They were allowed to pay off millions of dollars in fines with rocks. And I'm sure those were retail rocks, not wholesale rocks. That's not the price there at the head of that, at the dinosaur head at the Slate Quarry. That's the retail price there at Cave Depot. But McKesson will pay the state of West Virginia $37 million. This is a company that, again, as noted, in 1 year alone, reported revenues of $208.4 billion. Now, we all know the trouble I get into if I get anywhere near the idea of ciphering on the fly on this radio program. But I'm pretty sure that's $37 million on revenues of $208.4 billion is a drop in the bucket. They won't even feel it. Now, Jim Justice said that settlement ain't enough for his liking, but it's probably our best option. I don't think it's enough. I know how wealthy this company is, but at the same time, I'd rather take the money and get on what we need to be getting on with rather than just lose the money. Well, Jim, you dumbass, you wouldn't lose the money. You take the bastards to trial, you squeeze them. But then again, maybe Pill Push and Patty Morrissey, who probably has a soft spot for opioid manufacturers, seeing as how they helped him and his wife achieve a lifestyle to which they have since become quite accustomed. Maybe he just didn't have the stomach for it. And another reason for that that brain bleach is that I'm going to have to agree with Joe Manchin for a minute here. Because the rumors were swirling back in 2018, election time, of this settlement. They've just kind of waited until until they thought folks weren't looking to announce it. Because back during the campaign, Joe Manchin said a $35 million settlement with McKesson would constitute a mugging in broad daylight, that it wouldn't be enough to address what West Virginia pays out in a year as a result of the conduct of these remorseless purveyors of poison. And with the news of the actual settlement today, Manchin's office put out a press release and said it was a sweetheart settlement with McKesson, that it sold out West Virginia, and that it was horrific and inadequate. And, you know, he's right. Narrowly construing that, he is, he's right. The only problem is, Joe Manchin sells out the people of this state every day of his life. With every blast that goes off on a mountaintop removal site, Joe Manchin sells out the people of this state. He sells out the futures of unborn babies whose developing little developing bodies will be perhaps transformed in ways we don't even want to think about by those ultra-fine particulate poisons that his buddies in the coal industry generate. He said it's pennies on the dollar to what McKesson cost our state. That's true, too. Just like it's been determined for a very long time now that for every dollar the coal industry brings into the state of West Virginia, it costs the people of the state of West Virginia five. Now, I'm not so good at deciphering, but I'm guessing if you've got a $20 bill in your pocket, and let's say a coal baron comes up and says, I'm going to give you another dollar. And he gives you a dollar, you got $21 in your pocket. Then the coal baron says, give me five. Well, wait a minute. Okay, you got $16. Now here's another dollar. Okay, I got $17. Give me five. I got 12. Here's another dollar, that's three. That's 13. Now give me five, that's eight. Pretty soon, you don't have any money in your pocket. And that's the history of this mono economy. But in this particular case, yeah, Joe Manchin's right. Naturally, this is something up with which Pill Push and Patty Morrissey was not going to put. He sent out his press creep, Curtis Jackson, to say, Joe Manchin has no credibility to criticize any measures the state takes to clean up from the cataclysmic wake he left by driving West Virginia into the height of the opioid crisis while he was governor. I don't think Joe did that. Joe did a lot of stupid things. Joe continues to do a lot of stupid things. But of the stupid things that Joe did, that ain't one of them. No, that was doctors and pharmaceutical reps and pharmaceutical companies and, oh wait, pharmaceutical lobbyists like Pill Push and Patty Morrissey. While Attorney General Morrissey and subsequent governors have fought to realize historic recoveries from drug distributors, it seems Manchin's most significant impact in the opioid epidemic was the record-breaking numbers of pills he allowed proliferate throughout the state during his watch. Did you hear it? Did you hear what I just read? Yeah, the pusher is blaming the government for all the pills that the government, no, that the pushers sent into the state. They're trying to say, well, this is the biggest drug settlement we ever had. Well, a lot of these lawsuits had been begun by a good man by the name of Daryl McGraw when he was Attorney General. And I think it's safe to say Daryl McGraw would never have let his team of lawyers that were pretty good let these dirt bags off for $37 million. It needed to hurt. But Pill Push and Patty Morrissey doesn't have it in his heart to hurt his buddies in the pill pushing industry. if you figure the opioid crisis has been going on for 10 years, then and you know that it takes $8.8 billion a year, that's the cost to this state of it, then that settlement falls short by more than half. But it reminds me of something. I didn't note the other day when it happened. I was aware of it, but the time did not present itself within the program. John Singleton passed away, 51 years old, a massive stroke. And he was most famous for a film back in the 90s. And Dan Fisher and I Dan mentioned it. A film called Boys in the Hood. And there's a scene in that film that I saw when the news came out that he had passed away. That struck me as being profound then and profound now, because it's the so-called gentrification scene. Lawrence Fishburne explaining to his young charges in front of a billboard about buying property in the neighborhood just exactly what was going on. And I know it seems crazy that I would think about an opioid crisis in Appalachia by watching a scene from Boys in the Hood, but there's this thing called transferability, and this scene has it.
Why don't y'all take a look at that sign up there? See what it says? Cash for your home? You know what that is?
Billboard.
What are y'all, Amos and Andy? Are you stepping and he's fetching? I'm talking about the message, what it stands for. It's called gentrification. It's what happens when the property value of a certain area is brought down. Huh? You listening?
Yeah.
They bring the property value down. They can buy the land at a lower price. Then they move all the people out, raise the property value, and sell it at a profit. Now, what we need to do is we need to keep everything in our neighborhood, everything, black. Black-owned with black money, just like the Jews, the Italians, the Mexicans, and the Koreans do.
Ain't nobody from outside bringing down the property value. It's these folk shooting each other and selling that crack rock and shit.
Well, how you think the crack rock gets into the country? We don't own any planes. We don't own no ships. But we are not the people who are flying and floating that shit in here. I know every time you turn on the TV, that's what you see, black people selling the rock,
right.
pushing the rock. Yeah, I know. But that wasn't a problem as long as it was here. Wasn't a problem until it was in Iowa, and it showed up on Wall Street where there are hardly any black people. Now, if you want to talk about guns, why is it that there's a gun shop on almost every corner in this community?
Why?
Tell you why. For the same reason that there's a liquor store on almost every corner in the black community. Why? They want us to kill ourselves. You go out to Beverly Hills, you don't see that shit. But they want us to kill ourselves. Yeah, the best way you can destroy a people, you take away their ability to reproduce themselves.
Yeah.
Who is it that's dying out here on these streets every night? Y'all?
Yeah.
Young brothers like yourselves.
What am I supposed to do? Fool roll up, try to smoke me? I'm gonna shoot the motherfucker if he don't kill me first.
You're doing exactly what they want you to do. You have to think, young brother, about your future. Huh?
You have to think. But when I read the story about the opioid settlement, the sellout, that clip bounced immediately back to mind. Because you know what? Hillbillies don't own any planes. Hillbillies don't own any pharmaceutical companies. Most hillbillies don't own any coal companies. But Jim Justice owns planes. Jim Justice owns coal companies. Pill Push and Patty Morrissey worked for the pill companies. And they didn't accidentally dump a bunch of goddamned opioids into the middle of the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone because it was originally slated for delivery to Chicago. And that's the problem with Joe Manchin's crocodile tears about what a drop in the bucket this settlement is. The Mountaintop Removal Sacrifice Zone has been and continues to be depopulated. And the ones who stay tend to pay a horrible price for their stubbornness. And so the ones that won't leave, we'll ship them some pills. If they won't leave, they can die. And then the coal industry, it can continue to do what it does here with impunity. And they can say, well, hell, yeah, sure, we blast a little. But they ain't nobody lives there. They done left or died. See how it works? Yeah. Well, hey, look, Lee in New York has done did the ciphering for us. Drop in the bucket. $37 million out of $208.4 billion is 0.01775438% of their annual revenues for 1 year. And the pill pushers didn't have to admit guilt either, right? Says Jack in Shreveport. Right. Have you played this game before, Jack? No, that's not the Sackler family. And there's more opioid news out here. The Sacklers didn't get dinged. But by God, one billionaire did. John Kapoor. K-A-P-O-O-R, John Kapoor, 75 years old. He got busted by a jury in Boston, Massachusetts. He had founded a company called Insys Therapeutics, I-N-S-Y-S. And he came up with something called Subsys, or his company did, S-U-B-S-Y-S. Subsys is, because we don't have enough delivery methods for it, fentanyl spray. Now, the reason he wound up in court and the reason he wound up getting charged is because he messed with the money. He wasn't charged for with, you know, killing hillbillies or anything like that. He was charged with defrauding insurance companies. Don't fuck with their money. Okay? In particular, he was found guilty of having defrauded insurance companies in his attempt to push subsist fentanyl spray. The EPA approved subsist. They approved it for people who had terminal cases of cancer. But that's really not the market you want if you're an opioid manufacturer. Because if you can only sell it to them for 2 or 3 months before they shuffle off this mortal coil, well, by God, how are you going to afford that 24-karat solid gold toilet seat that you've always wanted? Yeah, not the EPA. I meant the FDA. I said EPA, didn't I? Yeah, Randy and PA. You mean the FDA. Sorry, had EPA on the brain from the previous story. So what John Kapoor and his company did is they decided to market their fentanyl spray into a larger and, as they say at the Harvard School of Business, more profitable market. And those more profitable markets started spraying the fentanyl. And the next thing you know, people were, well, dropping dead. It was John Kapoor and four other NSYS executives, all rung up on racketeering charges. After 2 weeks of deliberation by the jury, they face up to 20 years in prison. Like I said, it's not a Sackler, but it's a beginning. The story I'm looking at in The Guardian mentions the $37 million settlement here in West Virginia, but it doesn't mention that $37 million was 0.01775431.8% of the 1 year revenues for that shitty company. Among other things, what John Kapoor did is he shepherded a hustle in a more criminal context. We'd call it a hustle. When you're doing it in the tens of millions of dollars and you run a drug company, it's called a marketing strategy. He shepherded a marketing strategy that paid doctors. They went out and found doctors and hired them, and the doctors, you know, some of them are fucking Republicans. I went, well, sure, I'd like to have some money. You want some money? I like money. And so they paid over $1 million in doctors to prescribe high dosages of this fentanyl spray to patients who didn't need it. And they did it under the guise of seminars. And the seminars would they'd take place at, for instance, swanky restaurants in New York City. And then the drug reps after dinner, after it all settled down, they'd drug reps would take the doctors to strip joints. Two New York doctors got $260,000. And then they turned around and wrote $6 million in fentanyl spray prescriptions. $6 million in fentanyl spray prescriptions in 1 year. How do you even do that? I mean, wouldn't your prescription writing hand get a little tired? But maybe the... And if I was a juror, this would have spoken to me. They had a promotional video. No, really. They had a promotional video for hustling this nasty ass spray. Oh my God. Jesus. You spray the stuff under your tongue. 8 doctors, $1.1 million. And they hustled it with a promotional video, a promotional rap video, that showed sales reps for Kapoor's company, Insys, dancing next to a giant bottle of the fentanyl spray with the line in the video, "I got new patients, and I got a lot of them." The company's value went from $14 million in 2012 to over almost $500 million 5 years later. And John Kapoor had decided that it was time to get out. And so he was trying to figure out a way to sell not the company, but just, sell a little more fentanyl spray so he could retire in comfort and ease. The jury even found out that Kapoor and one of his associates, a person by the name of Berlikoff, straight up called what they were doing with the doctors bribing them. And they explained that in order to get the bribes, the doctors had to generate at least twice as much money for the fentanyl spray and for the company that they got in bribes. Somehow, I look at a story like that and I wonder, is up to 20 years in prison enough? If you were to ask the people who have buried their loved ones in this ongoing disaster, what do you reckon they would say as to whether 20 years in prison was enough? I mean, he's 75, that means 95, he'll never make it. So what? I mean, how many people died? How do you divide that into 20 years? I asked Jack in Shreveport, I said, you played this game before. And Jack wrote back and said, subject line, depopulation. Yep, played the game before. Think Katrina, flood insurance laws and regs and pricing, moving people to multiple states out of their voting districts, and on and on and on. That's right, Randy and PA pointing out. The Sackler family were execs of Purdue Pharma, who, after addicting lots of people, have now set up addiction recovery clinics. I wonder if the people who go to their addiction recovery clinics, you get to talk to horses like Rush Limbaugh did. I don't know. Thanks, Nydia. Nydia reminds us of some of the first opioid cases. Abbott Labs and their bold crusade to sell OxyContin in places like McDowell County, West Virginia. Nasty business. Waiting for it to load. The headline, Secret Trove, reveals Abbott's bold crusade to sell OxyContin. Goes back to 2016. It begins, as so many of these stories do. The pharmaceutical sales reps from healthcare giant Abbott Labs had a problem. No matter what they tried, they couldn't get the attention of an orthopedic surgeon to convince him to prescribe the potent painkiller OxyContin. Week after week, they dropped by his office, sometimes bringing lunch for the doctor and his staff. But he didn't have time for them. Yeah. But they got to him eventually, because his staff told him that what he really liked was junk food. And they took him a sheet cake box with donuts and snack cakes arranged to spell out the word OxyContin. The guy who put together the massive marketing campaign to spew this filth all over the country referred to himself as the King of Pain. And yeah, that's the Sacklers, and yeah, that's Purdue Pharma. Jesus. Thanks, Nydia. Thank you very kindly. News broke a little bit ago. This is sad. At 74 years old, the guy who originally played Chewbacca back when Star Wars was still cool has passed away. Peter Mayhew. Yeah. Speaking of gentrification, Ron in Raleigh says, since you brought it up, meant to send this earlier, but since you brought it up, I'll send it now. Gentrification is going like a house on fire here in Raleigh. I told people about the pattern of white flight and return in the 80s. A friend of mine summarizes this in the statement. You see white folks walking dogs, then the plan is in full effect. Lots of white folks walking dogs in what was once black neighborhoods in Raleigh. Our buddy Lottie. Subject line, tip of the iceberg, and Lottie's up Boston way, so the Kapoor incis case has been all over the news up there. Lottie says, welcome to the world that I worked in and saw. You talked about one drug, one company, a few executives, and a few doctors. Multiply those by thousands, and you may get an idea of why our healthcare is where it's at. No doubt. And that extends beyond opioids, Lottie. The drive for profits is driving this country into the dirt. Now, I don't know if we could ever move to, and I don't know that I'd want to, move to pure, straight-up Karl Marx-style socialism. I mean, we've managed to run this radio network for a lot of years now without getting all capitalist about it. Think about it. I mean, can you find another effort out there that has never charged anybody for anything? Because we have it. The program's free. The live stream is free. The archives are free. Everything's free. And we ask the people who have the ability to kick in for people who don't, so that everybody can have it. You don't find that theory in operation very much on a broader basis. You just don't. But yeah, Lottie is absolutely right. It is the tip of an iceberg. And it's a minor miracle that these punk asses got convicted in Boston. And don't think for a minute that they don't have the money to appeal the living bejesus out of their convictions and hire some pettifogger who will find some thin reed upon which to hang an allegation of trial court error. Let's see. Nah, I hate to keep people on hold. I was gonna go to the Green News Report, but let's go to the phones first. Hey, welcome to the program.
Is this Bob?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. This is Charlie down in Tennessee.
Oh, hey, Charlie, how are you?
Well, I'm recovering from a blood clot.
Ah, damn. I mean, okay, the recovering part is good. The blood clot's the damn part.
Yeah. Yeah, my leg swole up, looked like it was a tree trunk rather than a leg.
Oh, shit.
But, yeah, I'm recovering from that. But what you were talking about in West Virginia and Virginia, most of the people that have moved down to Tennessee from Virginia and West Virginia, their whole life ambition is to sell what land they own up there. And, you know, what they'll do is they'll just remove the topsoil and blast into the rock and get all the minerals out and then cover it over with a little bit of just, you know, topsoil or whatever. That's it. I mean, they basically, and it doesn't bother them. As long as they can get money out of it, they don't care.
Well, I mean, you're talking about just ordinary folks?
Yeah, the ones that maybe own some land in Virginia, like around Pound or somewhere like that. Or
I know where Pound is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a hell of a choice to have to make, Charlie. I mean, I know people who have made the choice. A coal company comes in, and they start blasting the living hell out of the area around you, and they'll pretty much they'll surround you, and then they'll come in and they'll offer you money and say get out. And at that point in time, maybe your water's been poisoned, your foundation's been cracked. Your windows are loose in their settings. The air's not fit to breathe. The ground's poisoned, so you can't plant a garden. The roads are ruined by coal trucks. It's kind of hard to give them hell when they sell out.
The specific example that I was thinking of, there was a man that his parents left him some land up in Pound, Virginia, and he moved down to Kingsport and got a job at Appalachian Power. And basically, that was his ambition in life, was to sell that land so it could be strip mine. And, you know, he really didn't care about...
Well, if he owned the minerals, I'm sure they paid him rather well.
Yeah, but still, I mean, think what you're doing. I mean, you're just about... That's just about like committing suicide.
Well, it's more like committing homicide if you're getting out of town and leaving everybody else to deal with it.
Yeah. And I cannot understand that mentality.
Well, that's because you've got some morality and some ethics motivating you, Charlie. This is not the country for that. I mean, I know there's a place in, well, it's Kanawha County, one county away from here. It's the little place that one of our leaders, Larry, struggled and fought for and put together a family trust. And it used to be one of the low spots among all the mountains, and now it's the highest point for miles around.
Yeah. And, you know, they'll go in and they'll start underground mining. And then they'll go in and they'll start pulling pillars out of the mine. And eventually the mine will cave in, and that causes all kinds of problems. And, you know, you really got problems if the mine goes back far enough where the whole damn mountain just kind of settles down. Whenever they start pulling pillars and it finally caves in.
Yeah. Oh, pulling pillars is one of the dirtier pieces of work, right. But Larry, you know, Larry Gibson protected that one little piece of ground, and they surrounded him and did everything they could to try to get him to abandon it. But like you, Larry had a well-developed moral and ethical sense, and he wouldn't sell out. But there are a lot of people who won't do that.
There's something going on in West Knoxville, down toward it's West Knoxville, about down toward Lenore City, and they have just literally just shaved the top off of the mountain.
It might vary.
And I'm not aware of any coal there or anything. I don't know why they did it.
That's a little too far. You'd think that was a little too far south for coal, because the mountaintop removal that takes place in Tennessee is that little area, that little notch up there by you know, Johnson City and Kingsport and around in there.
Yeah. Well, they did some mining in Monterey and Cookeville up in that area many, many years ago.
Right, yeah.
And, I don't know, it's just, I don't know what's going on. Whenever I was over in West Knoxville and I saw that, where literally the top of the mountain was shaved off, I thought, you know, there's not any seams of coal here. I wonder what they are getting into. And then on over, you got the Clinch River.
Sure.
Where the power plant is down in Kingston.
Yeah, that was a nightmare.
And so I don't think people understand what's going to happen if those coal ash ponds ever start breaking loose again, and they have a major, you know, major, just the coal ash just gets into the river. I mean, there's not going to be water to drink or anything.
Well, Charlie, that's not an if, that's a when. And if most Americans had any idea how much of that filth is in their world, they'd be horrified. And so that's why they aren't told about it, because they might rise up on their hind legs and start acting like, you know, citizens with rights and stuff like that. I mean, that Kingston coal ash disaster, remember, all that super toxic coal ash was gathered up and put on railroad cars and sent down to a majority black community poor as poor could be, called Perry County, Alabama, and now the people who live around there are getting sick and dying.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I can't imagine that, you know, all these people that go and dress up and sit in church every Sunday, that's the type of people that do stuff like that. And it's sickening. I mean, you know.
Well, some of it's a function of avarice, some of it's a function of ignorance. And that combination, as we've learned far too many times, Charlie, can be deadly.
And another place that I really don't like to go, but I run service calls up there all the time, is Oak Ridge. We don't know what's in the, what is at Oak Ridge.
Oh, God, no. I mean, it's amazing this far along that everybody in Oak Ridge doesn't have a baby's arm growing out of their head.
I mean, nothing is ever said about it or anything. And you know that back during World War II, there was probably stuff buried and everything else.
Well, that's the first nuclear reactor, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
You know, it's, I tell you what, right around the Knoxville area, it's, you know, Kingston and Oak Ridge and all these places like that. I mean, it's not, it's just not a good place to live.
You know, on the way back from the first Molloy Fest last December, we overnighted, I guess, somewhere around Johnson City. And it's beautiful country. Breathtakingly beautiful, but it's another, it's another place that's had the living be Jesus abused out of it.
Yeah,
and they were all proud of their bass fishing in that lake that's there. And it, well, remember Don Blankenship moved down that way for a while. What does that tell you?
Yeah, that is true. And then you've got Eastman and Kingsport, and God knows what they've buried.
Well,
chemical company.
Yeah, yeah. Let me. Eastman Chemical. Yeah, they're the folks that hipped the coal companies here to a little something called methyl cyclohexane methanol. Didn't really tell anybody what it would do if human beings were exposed to it, but hey, what are the chances of that ever happening? And now there are 300,000 people in 9 counties in West Virginia who are participating in an involuntary human study on the effects of methyl cyclohexane methanol on a massive massive dose over the space of 9 counties.
And I was born and raised in Kingsport.
Well, you mentioned service calls and stuff. Since you had that blood clot, are you back up and around?
Oh yeah. I took about 3 days off from work. They wanted me to take more than that, but I really didn't have the time. They started me out on Xarelto. And this is the second blood clot I've had, so they said it's pretty much going to be a lifelong thing. And I'll be eligible for Medicare in October. So I don't know, you know, if that'll help or not.
Well, having health care is a good thing, so maybe you can make some proactive choices. I mean, but, you know, I don't think you're out there living the life of Riley as it is. You've never struck me as somebody who's prone to close the bars and keep the drug dealers in business. So,
well, I never did. I never, you know, I've smoked pot and stuff like that. But this was back in my early 20s, and you know, after I got my middle 20s, I just kind of lost interest in it. You know.
Right.
You know, I'm 64 now, so that, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a whole lot more fun to give people hell when you're straight than if you're stoned.
Well, yeah, it kind of makes it a little, it gives you a little bit of, I guess, a little bit of moral heft, right?
Well, I mean, you know, they don't, if they start that crap about, well, you don't know what you're talking about, look at you, you're stoned. You, no, I'm not, I'm straight. I do know what I'm talking about. Oh, law. But, yeah, I'm, and this area of Tennessee has changed in the last, I left in 1987, so it'd be 87, 90, what was that, about 30-something years ago?
Yeah, thereabouts, yeah.
And, you know, you see people now, these kids got their pickup truck with a rebel flag flying on the back of it, and you just sit there and you shake your head and you just think, you know, that looks bad on all white people for you to do that, so why in the hell are you doing it?
Yeah, but you can't. I mean, maybe 1 in 100 you'd get through to. But, you know, look, they've still got a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest on the Capitol grounds in Nashville. The father of the damn Klan.
Yeah. Well, there used to be one down on Interstate 65 down toward Franklin.
Isn't he still there? That was Stonewall Jackson, though. What? Or was that Forrest?
I think that was Nathan Bedford Forrest.
I know it was. I know there, it was uglier than Homemade Sin.
Yeah.
Last time I went down that way, I was looking for it, and I couldn't tell if they'd managed to plant trees around it or if it was just gone.
It used to be in a fenced-in area with a lot of flags around it, and it was right beside the railroad track off of Interstate 65.
I remember it well, because it was privately owned land, and there was nothing anybody could do about it.
Yeah.
Now you got me curious now. Next time I'm down that way, I'm going to slow down and pay a little more attention.
It may not be there anymore. I never have been back to Nashville. I've got relatives around here. I was born in Kingsport, and I live in Morristown now. So, you know, I'm pretty close to where I was born and raised. I'm about 40 or 50 miles from where I was born and raised. So, but it didn't used to be like it is now. I mean, you know, people would look down on something like if you went flying a rebel flag on the back of your car, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or a truck or whatever. But it's, I don't know why, and it only seems to have happened since Trump got in office.
Okay, well, I think I'm seeing an answer here as far as that statue's concerned. It was back in 2017 when the mayor of the little town near that stupid statue, a woman named Heidi Campbell, wrote to Governor Haslam and said, what we need is a bunch of shrubberies planted on state property around this thing so nobody can see it.
Oh, okay. But, you know, the person who put that statue there still, I mean, somebody needs to sit down and talk with him and say,
well, it wouldn't know, be, I don't even know
that,
if he still...
That offends people, and it's not a good thing to offend people.
Well, the owner, back in 2017, that. The owner was a guy by the name of Bill Doris, and he was 80 years old, and he said, well, if they plant trees or keep, I'm going to build it taller so people can still see it.
Oh, yeah.
But God, if you go on your favorite search engine and look up I-65 Confederate statue, I mean, this, I don't know who did it. It's ugly. I mean, but ugly. And the face of this thing is just, oh, Jesus. He looks a little like, I don't know, the Wicked Witch of the West with a beard. And the horse is like, and the horse is like, you know, well, the horse is, it's been, let's put it this way. It has been artistically modified a couple of times. General Forrest and his noble steed have been painted pink.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, that happened once.
Well,
yeah.
I just can't understand. And I bet you whoever this 80-year-old clown is that owns this, I bet you'll see him sitting in his church every Sunday.
Oh, no doubt. Good Christian. Good Christian.
Yeah. And that just, you know, that's, you know, back, if you read in the, where Paul was talking about eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols.
Yeah.
He said it really doesn't matter, but he said, if it offends somebody, I will never eat meat again. You just don't do things that offend people.
Yeah, that's where he was talking about stumbling blocks.
Yeah. Yeah, putting a stumbling block in front of somebody, yeah. And, you know, you just don't do things like that. And why people do it, I don't know.
Well, beats the daylights out of me, too. Charlie, it's good to hear from you. All of our best in your recovery. And, you know, take your meds like you're supposed to and be good and holler back.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, talk to you later. Bye now.
Bye.
It's our buddy Charlie in Tennistan. It's nothing to go looking for, but Confederates is so stupid, and they have no taste. Nathan Bedford Forrest, Klansman that he was, war criminal. What was it, the Fort Pillow Massacre? Yeah. He would be horrified. That ain't me. Jesus. But he does look good in pink. He really does. Let's keep thinking. Well, I'll tell you what. No. You're going to take a break and then come back. Go to the phones. Skype line is open. 304-574-8178. Somebody's on the stress line. If you're there, stay there. And we'll come back after the Green News Report. And again, a reminder, it's May 2nd, not March 2nd. Don't let that throw you. And by the way, we had $200 to raise this evening, and we are at zero. We got off to a roaring start yesterday with Shirley's Challenge, and today, not so much. But that's okay. We'll figure out a way. Jack in Shreveport pointed out a few minutes ago, the horn. One thing that always comes to my mind is that small businesses average about 5 years before they go out of business. The horn's way out of their league. That's because it's not a business. That's because we're not motivated by profit. That's because nobody's here dreaming of Gulfstream Fives or trying to figure out some way to make their pitiful right-wing lives appear to have meaning. Nobody's sending out the help with a cigar box full of money, hoping she'll bring it back as a cigar box full of OxyContin. It's not happening here. It's just a community that wants to keep all this going. And if you don't have to be rich, and if you can live on little, this can work. If this had been some sort of a business with a goal of making whopping profits, it would have been gone years ago. But because it's a community that takes care of everybody else, because we have people here who keep the program on the air so that anybody who ever wants to listen to it, regardless of whether they got money or not, can listen to it, participate in it, call it, well, it makes all the difference in the world. All right, Brad and Desi, what do you got?
It's Thursday, March 2nd, 2019.
It's hard to argue that there's anything more important facing this country this generation today, and more importantly, every generation that follows.
Climate action is now a major plank for Beto and Booker in the 2020 Democratic presidential primary. New poll shows climate change is a top issue for voters. Jakarta and Washington, D.C. grapple with rising sea levels. Plus,
today's bill says no how, no way are you going to drill off the coast of Long Island and New York. It's not going to happen as long as we are in charge of this state.
New York State bans offshore drilling and plastic bags.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Unfortunately, we have a federal government that perpetuates the state of denial.
They got to do something for a living, Governor Cuomo. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, there has been so much going on so many fronts, we have not even been able to keep our eyes on the continuing flooding going on in the upper Midwest.
Yes, unfortunately, a new round of storms in the upper Midwest has brought a new round of flooding to communities that were hit by floods just last month. A major levee failure on Wednesday flooded downtown Davenport, Iowa, with several feet of water and forcing evacuations. But levees won't help the city of Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. The Indonesian government this week announced that it is developing plans to relocate its capital out of the city of Jakarta and rebuild it in a new location because Jakarta is sinking. Mm. It's the fastest sinking city in the world because of subsidence and rising sea levels. At current rates, Jakarta is projected to be mostly underwater by 2050.
And when they move Jakarta, they're going to have to move it into the rainforest, destroying rainforest, making climate change even worse in the bargain.
There aren't really any good solutions
here.
No,
there aren't. Get used to it.
In politics, climate change is now officially a major plank of the 2020 Democratic presidential primary race. Several candidates have released progressive climate action platforms. This week, former Texas Congressman and Democratic hopeful Beto O'Rourke rolled out a broad and ambitious climate policy that includes mobilizing $5 trillion in infrastructure investments by 2030, transitioning to clean energy, banning drilling on public lands, and leveraging the federal government's purchasing power, all to get to net zero emissions by 2050.
$5 trillion with a T?
Yep. Here he is on MSNBC.
We cannot do this by half measure or by only half of us. It can't be Democrats versus Republicans, big cities versus small towns. We all have a shared interest in a cleaner future for this country.
Good for him for telling it like it is. It is going to cost trillions of dollars. But that's less than what it will cost if we don't take action.
Also this week, 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey unveiled his environmental justice policy plan, calling environmental inequality a key civil rights issue that is also a massive public health problem. He noted that data shows that low-income and marginalized communities disproportionately bear the brunt of pollution in the United States, with higher rates of birth defects and autism. Booker's plan would invest in upgrading the nation's infrastructure, tightening pollution standards, and making polluters pay.
Many people are not paying the full cost of the production of their product, and we've got to change that. And so I'm going to make sure that we, number one, have infrastructure investments to secure clean water, and number two, we hold polluters accountable.
Not paying the full cost for the production of their product, meaning they get to pollute for free, and we get to pay to clean it up.
Exactly. And for the first time, voters ranked climate change as their number one top issue, at least among Democratic primary voters. That's according to a new national poll by CNN. CNN's poll found 82% of Democratic primary voters say climate change is very important to them.
That even beats healthcare?
Yeah.
Wow.
And more action is unfolding around the country. The City Council of Washington, D.C. has adopted a new resilience plan that calls for retrofitting or removing all flood-prone buildings by 2050. They are the first major U.S. city to set such a policy.
Can't we just move them to the rainforest?
Nevada's Democratic governor has signed a bill requiring Nevada's electricity companies to get half of their energy from renewable sources by 2030. Maine this week became the first state to ban single-use plastic foam containers.
Man, is it nice to have Governor Paul LePage gone.
And finally, in New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law a measure banning offshore drilling in state waters and prohibit state agencies from permitting pipelines or any other infrastructure that might help facilitate offshore drilling. It's a preemptive effort to block President Trump's plans to expand offshore drilling to all U.S. coastal waters. And at the same time, New York Governor Cuomo signed into law a statewide plastic bag ban.
Good for him. Good for the Empire State. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I'm in a New York state of mind. It was so easy living day by day.
And I had a note come in from Ralphs, who, of course, is a big part of the Shirley's Memorial Challenge on the first of the month. And Ralphs said, "Don't make me sick crook on you all. You don't want crook after you. Come on, everybody. Let's knock it down. Don't make me sick crook on you all." Thanks, Ralphs. Thanks a bunch. Meanwhile, up in Illinois, James says, "Well, it does feel like March 2nd here south of Chicago. It feels almost like winter's trying for a comeback." Well, see, that's because Chicago, James. I mean, the late, great Louis Grizzard once observed that Chicago has two seasons, dead of winter and 4th of July. 4th of July is still coming. You know, Game of Thrones, they've got winter is here, or winter is coming. Y'all just deal with winter is here. All kidding. No, I'm kidding, of course, but I'm just so damn grateful to have a little bit of warmth and, you know, it's nice when the wind blows and the wind's warm instead of, like, feels like it's cutting through you. Hey, thanks, Charlie. Thanks for getting us started. That means we got $150 to go this evening. Thanks so much. Let's run over to the stress line and check in with Nidia. Hey, Nidia, how are you?
Well, wonderful. And the reason I sent you that article, Bob, is because that story, even though it's dated 2016, that's when that story came out. That case was actually settled in 2004. For $10 million, only $10 million in the state of West Virginia, because of at that time Abbott was doing the marketing for Purdue. And that those documents were sealed for years. And so I thought you'd find that interesting.
Yes.
Because some of the most gross marketing tactics were used by those pharmaceutical reps. But the other thing I wanted to share with your listeners, I thought you might find it interesting because these days I am working as an addictions therapist in West Virginia, and what I am seeing is that the opiate epidemic, you'll keep hearing people saying, "Oh, it's getting better, oh, it's really getting better,
no, it's not.
We're doing such a great job." But what I am also seeing is that the increase in meth is profound. It is really frightening. It is extensive, and that's not getting a whole lot of attention. I wanted to mention two other things. One is that maybe your listeners know this, maybe they don't, but a lot of my clients didn't know this. Heroin was sold over the counter years ago, and it was actually produced by Bayer Corporation. So there's a very long history with all this, right?
Well, and
another
in the
aspect.
Go ahead, please. No, please continue.
Well, another aspect to this I wanted to bring up, and I was recently in a meeting with one of the West Virginia delegates, and I raised this with him, and I'll tell you what he said. But one of the other things I'm seeing is the white people I see are usually coming in relation to opiates or meth. The African-American people, particularly men who come to the place where I work, they are court-ordered there because of weed. And I find this absolutely amazing. Like, seriously, in the scheme of things, with what is going on, seriously? So I raised this issue with a delegate. I happened to be in a meeting with him, and I said, you know, is anybody keeping data on this? Like, isn't this an issue of concern? And what he said to me, and it kind of hit me in the head, and I went, oops. And I then did a little more research and found out he's right, is that it's a national problem. and I wasn't aware of that. But there's this huge disparity going on. And now with medical marijuana coming to the state, it raises, I'm sorry about my clock dinging, it raises a whole series of issues about what's going to happen as more and more people are using weed, marijuana, cannabis, whatever you want to call it, for medical purposes.
Well, just to back up for a minute, did you get any kind of a response on the referring to drug treatment for weed? I mean, that's ludicrous.
But that's what's happening, and I'm telling you, if you talk to anybody in the field, in this state, and apparently nationwide, and I didn't know that. I'd love to know if that's really nationally this is true. But I am telling you, in West Virginia, this is definitely true. And I am seeing, and it's mostly men, African-American men, are court-ordered into treatment for weed and weed only.
Because they got busted standing outside smoking a blunt or maybe, you know, honking on a vape pen or something like that. But I thought we had drug courts now. Is this coming out of the drug court?
It comes, so they go, they're picked up for whatever reason, and the courts order them into treatment. It is treated as seriously an addiction by the courts as meth and heroin. Now, I do want to clarify something so I don't mislead anybody, and if any of my coworkers are listening to the show. You know, alcohol, they say about 90% of people can use alcohol. Occasionally, it's not a problem. They're not binge drinkers, no issue. 10% of people, it becomes a serious health, you know, a threatening problem, and they develop dependence and addiction. Well, with marijuana, even though it works totally differently, what the research, and there's not a vast body of it, but what the research we have so far shows is about 10% of people also with marijuana will develop a dependence on that. And your listeners may be going, why? What is she talking about?
No,
here's
it's
what
true.
I mean. So, it affects memory. It can affect your motivation. You will see a lot of people when they discontinue it for whatever reason, if they were daily users, they get angry, they can't sleep, they have the sweats. I mean, there are issues with it. So anyone who says, oh, there's absolutely, it's just the greatest thing ever, and there are no issues with it whatsoever, and nobody will ever suffer a consequence, that's not true. However, when you compare this in terms of the impact
right.
and severity on people's lives to what's happening with meth, and for anyone who's really interested in the topic of meth, I will recommend a book that is just beautiful. It was done a number of years ago called Beautiful Boy. And it's written by a guy who used to write, I think, for the New York Times, and how his son became addicted to meth. And he also includes a lot of science in the book. And I am here to tell you that meth is so damaging that it can take people years for their brain to recover. So, again, opiates are killing a lot of people. By the way, meth, too, you can overdose, not in the same way we think about, you know, heroin, but you can have a heart attack, you can have a stroke. Some people even cough up parts of their lungs. All right, so here we are with all this going on, and we don't have enough treatment for people, and we could debate about the effectiveness of this, and we have people court-ordered for weed.
And we don't have the beds. We don't have the resources. And if you're court ordering somebody for weed into treatment, aren't you just sort of backdooring some financial punishment? Oh, wait a minute, Nydia. The daggum Bluetooth tooth dropped you. Just hold on a second. Don't go anywhere. This happens on this box. We'll be back in a second. Just as soon as I turn away. Just bear with me, please. All right, we got you back.
What I had asked you is,
are they, and this comes by a question from Jack in Shreveport, With these weed referrals, isn't it, that doesn't that feel a little bit like a backdoor, sort of backdooring some financial punishment, you know, for a weed bust? Because the last I checked, in this state, possession of less than 15 grams is a damn misdemeanor in the first place.
Well, I cannot, you know, I'm on the treatment end, and so I don't know what's causing this. I don't know. I'd love to hear what your listeners think. What I'm telling you is people come in, and they're, in most cases, kind of angry, and I don't blame them, because they're like, I don't really need to be here. And what I attempt to do is, look, I understand that. Let's make the best of this that we can, because the alternative is if they don't come in and aren't, and I hate this term, compliant with treatment, they're going to end up in prison. And my objective is to help them through this process if they truly do have an issue with it, help them with that, but also be able to navigate out of the criminal justice system, right?
Sure.
Now, one other thing I just wanted to throw at you in case your listeners are interested, while we're on the whole topic of pharmaceuticals and the industry and the profiteering, is there's an excellent article in the April 8th edition of the New Yorker about a woman who was so loaded up with psychotropic medications. And you know what they do. I mean, if you have a side effect from one, then they give you another one and another one and another one. And before you know it, you don't even know who you are. And it's called Bitter Pill. And I would highly suggest anybody interested in this topic take a look at it, because we are at the point now, one of eight of every American is on an antidepressant, and one of every five women. That is astronomical.
Well, yeah, it is. And is that a commentary on one in five women, or is that a commentary on the nature of our culture and society?
My guess would be it's probably both, but you sort that out. I don't know. What I can tell you is that the mental health drug industry has also exploded. And while I'm not arguing there's no place whatsoever to help people get through a rough patch, maybe they respond well to it, there's also, as far as depression and anxiety, and this is coming from National Institute of Health, I'm not getting this from the National Enquirer, that walking is as effective as an antidepressant as medication. So why aren't we starting with that? Why is the first impulse you've got to be on Prozac or Paxil or whatever? And I don't know if you remember this, but a few years ago, the General Accounting Office did a study on foster children, and I don't have it right in front of me, but it was absolutely appalling. It was something like 90% of all kids in foster care are on multiple psychotropic medications. And that has tremendous impact on the developing brain. Now, why is that happening? Why is that happening? Was that true 30 years ago? Yes, people have more complex problems today. Yes, kids are under an awful lot of duress. But should that be the first line of treatment? And this is what it's come to. So I think there's a whole other dynamic here, which is we're teaching people anytime you want to cry, and crying could be a normal response to grief. No, no, we can't cry. You got to take a drug. And that also has an impact in terms of why do my clients use, let's talk about heroin, right?
Right.
And we go through this all the time. Well, let's see. I want to numb the pain. I am bored. And boredom, by the way, in West Virginia is a huge trigger. I'm bored. I'm angry. I'm sad. I've been unemployed for too long, and I want to, you know, escape. Maybe I started because I wanted to have fun. But it's gotten to the point that the typical reaction in the United States when you are having any kind of emotional duress, you got to take a pill, whether it's prescription or a street drug. Right?
Yeah, and there's not a lot of community yoga centers out there for people who don't have a bunch of means.
That's right.
I'm being a little sarcastic.
So I don't want to take up too much
Nidia, Nidia, unless you're in a hurry, I would really love to ask you a couple of extra questions because you're, for instance, our pal Cindy, who has been a friend of this program for eons, said, we don't have marijuana in our courts anymore. This is out on the left coast. because we legalized it. We save public money. We have a shitload of new sales taxes in the coffers. We don't have income tax here. Just sales tax runs the state along with real property taxes. Our county addiction units are now allowed to center on the real problems, heroin, OxyContin mostly. Addicts are 98% white. Our towns are cleaner than before the law was changed. And so it sounds like a net positive. And what I mean, you know you've been with this listening to the program for a while. You know what all the things I focus
years.
On.
Yeah. For years I've been listening to you.
You know, if you go down to Pineville or if you
Wyoming County.
Or if you go down to Welch or
I'd go down to Welch.
What is there? I mean,
I know it.
Saying I'm bored to some people may sound sort of shitty and privileged, if I could put it that way, but it's not.
Oh, no, you know where, given where you live, in the context here, it's very real. And it's not just boredom. It's people feel abandoned. I know you've talked a lot about sacrifice zones, and it is definitely part of that dynamic. That's not to say that people with higher incomes can't develop addiction disorders, but what we see here is feeling abandoned. I have an awful lot of clients that were coal miners. They got injured. They got started by the doctors on these drugs, and now they can't get jobs. Or they're working in a fast food place. Like, really? You think that they're not, like, you know, depressed or want to turn to something that, let's be real here, why do people use drugs? Despite all the consequences, the reality is, it makes them feel better,
yeah.
At least initially, right?
Initially, okay. Or for a very short period of time, right? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So there is this huge void, and for us to be able to start the healing process for individuals and the state, it's going to take a lot more than drug treatment centers. It's going to mean we have to give people meaning, and we have to give them jobs that pay a living wage and they can have some dignity. And we are so far from that, as you know.
Well, it's like there's no interest in it. Let me ask you this, Nidia. At first it was, you know, it was pills, it was opioids. And then as quickly as we figured out there was a problem with those and we figured that out late, then boom, there's heroin. And we go for, and then boom, fentanyl. Without you know, without you going into any particulars or specifics or anything that would be an ethical, what's the mix on opiates? Is it mostly pills or is it mostly heroin? Is it an even mix?
It's definitely the prescription pills, but there's a lot of heroin and a lot of heroin is laced with fentanyl. I have had people, believe it or not, that have overdosed 10 times. And finally something happens where, you know, for everybody it's different why, whether it's court ordered or something happens, they're, you know, worried about their children is often a big motivation, or they realize, you know, I came so close to death. For everybody it's different. But I'm seeing still a lot of heroin and a lot of it is laced with fentanyl. And for that matter, rat poison, for all I know. I mean, half the time you don't even know what people are getting.
Well, sure. That leads to another question. You know, you mentioned, you know, supposedly on July 1st, we're going to have a medical marijuana law in West Virginia. I'm highly skeptical because it seems like they wrote that law with the intention of making it as inaccessible as possible to people.
You know, it was Delegate Pushkin. I asked the question, and you know who he is, about why African Americans are coming in for treatment because of weed. He was, and like I said, he looked at me and he said, "You know, Nidia, it's a national problem." And I went, "Bing! Oh, okay, you're right." But I asked him about the question you're raising, and what he told me, and please, if I butcher this, I apologize, because this is secondhand, and maybe I didn't get it right. What I heard him say was it is going to take a while for them to get all the regulations in place. And something about, and I don't really understand this, the vertical integration versus the horizontal, and they had to straighten that out. And then here's the part I mostly don't understand. I really am going to need to. And that is you will not get a prescription for it. Rather, the doctor will write a recommendation. Did you hear this? And you will take that recommendation into one of the dispensaries, And because insurance won't pay for it, so there's no prescription. And here's the dilemma this presents for me, and I've asked this question where I work and other people in the field. What if I have a client that comes in for treatment of meth, right? And we routinely do screening. We have to. It's part of the program. And they keep showing up as positive for THC from the weed, right? That will be grounds to kick them out of the drug treatment program. You do understand that, right?
Oh, yeah. You'll have to the regs will have to be rewritten unless the person can, I mean, the regs will have to be rewritten so that if the person shows a recommendation that's...
No, I was told, and even Pushkin said, nope, if you're in there for drug treatment, that means you've got to show negative for everything. Okay, so this is going to raise a whole bunch of other questions because let's assume, I mean, it could be, I forget all the list of things that medical marijuana will cover, but let's say somebody is with glaucoma, all right?
Yeah.
But they also have an addiction disorder for alcohol, meth. Yeah, and by the way, I neglected to say this. I would say the majority of my clients these days are using multiple drugs, right?
Sure.
So it's meth, it's heroin, and it's cannabis. And again, I'm making an exception here about the majority of African-American men, and it's men, I see it's weed only, the majority. But if you're coming in for those things and you had glaucoma, the doctor said, I think you should get the weed for that, but you're in drug treatment for the other, and you get this positive test for the THC, which, by the way, stays in your system a lot longer than these other drugs, sometimes for over a month,
right?
You're going to be kicked out.
And that's another problem entirely. If you've got a condition for which you can get a recommendation, and that just drives me crazy. It seems like this bill was written in the worst possible way.
Well, I don't think the bill addressed that. That's coming more from the drug treatment community, that if you test positive for anything, you're out.
No. But I'm talking
prescription for it.
Right, but the prescription is just a recommendation. It's not a real prescription, like you were describing.
Right. Exactly.
I'm sure you're aware of this based on the demographic of the people that you deal with, Nidia. You can't get a job at the Rippy Mart without passing a drug test. You cannot get an $8 an hour job without passing a drug test. And in the case of cannabis, it's particularly frustrating because, you know, maybe somebody smoked a joint 2 days ago. Well, they're going to pee dirty.
Yeah, they will. They will.
But it doesn't show that there's no way of knowing that they're impaired on the job or anything like that.
Well, this is the state of affairs, and it's pretty bad. Despite all the rhetoric you hear about more and more money is being allocated to drug treatment and all this other stuff, there's some underlying issues here which are really disturbing. And finally, I just want to throw this out. Your listeners may be more educated than I am on this, and I haven't had the time to research it like the way I would like to. But what's really interesting to me is looking at the countries where drug treatment is treated more as a medical or biopsychosocial problem than a criminal problem. And, you know, as you know, we're very much still, it's driven by the criminal justice system. So when you force people into treatment, you tell me, do you think they're going to do better that way?
No.
Are they going to do better when they are motivated?
Right.
Right.
And when they're treated like human beings. But that's a function of the broader discussion of the strain of Puritanism that still runs through this country. I mean, there's nobody, it's my understanding, there's nobody harder on driving under the influence, for instance, than Germany. You know, they simply will not tolerate it. But
okay.
But they treat it as a psychosocial bio problem, like you said, instead of instead of, you know, trying to ruin somebody's life.
Right, exactly.
And they have much better success rates. But
Portugal is the...
Go ahead.
People keep pointing to Portugal. I just don't know at this point if their outcomes are that much better. I don't know. I do know what we're doing is not very effective. And finally, I just want to throw this out. One of the things that we really don't know is the data, despite what the feds say, the data is not very good. Because if you are treating somebody for an addiction disorder, to be able to follow them for 5 years and see what the relapse rate is, I don't trust the data that's out there. What I can tell you is I'm guessing now, just based on what I see, if we're seeing 30% stay in recovery for 5 years, that's really good.
That's almost too good to believe.
Well, that may be. So I would love to hear what your listeners think based on this, particularly this thing about African-American people. If the states where cannabis is still illegal, are they seeing that too? Or is this unique to West Virginia? Again, Pushkin said to me, it's national. I don't know. Okay, so I'm going to jump off. I'd love to hear what you're saying.
All right, Nydia, thank you so much for bringing that. You're just a treasure trove of information. And you know, please keep me posted. Call in or email or whatever, and let me know what you know in the way of developments. Because one of that, with the coming so-called legalization on July 1, I find myself thinking more and more that's not gonna change things for a whole lot of people in this state, simply because you know the black market is going to be the black market. And I don't know about, and maybe we'll find out here in a minute, I don't know about places like California or Washington or Oregon or Massachusetts, any of the legalization states. I don't know what happened to their cannabis black market, but I know it's not going to go away with the scheme that we have coming in on July 1. Because people want to vape it. I'm sorry, Nydia, the stupid phone. Hang on a minute. It did it to me again. I lost her. I don't know. But in a world that's plagued with fentanyl, you know, bathtub fentanyl, whatever, you don't know what you're getting. I saw a post on social media from inside West Virginia the other day. And I don't know if it's true or if it's just more misinformation that floats around on social media, but that fentanyl burning smells like popcorn. And that if you smell anything that smells like popcorn in your vape cartridge or in your weed, it may be laced with fentanyl. And of course, I'm from that generation that comes from the era when the U.S. government decided to go down and spray Mexican and Colombian cannabis fields with paraquat. And so everybody was worried about paraquat-laced weed. Well, fentanyl's an even bigger worry, plain and simple. Thank you very kindly to Cindy for jumping in. That means we've only got $125 left to finish the evening. And Nydia, please, I'm sorry about the technical problems with the phone. Hopefully that'll be remedied very, very soon. Please call back in. This is such an important topic. And, you know, sadly, West Virginia's a canary in the coal mine for it. And I don't, if you're still listening, Nydia, please know that Steve from Georgistan found our conversation to be really, really compelling and helpful. Jack in Shreveport said the same thing. That was a really great conversation. Nydia, N-I-D-I-A is her name, Jack. Cindy says, feeling bad about the state of the nation, doing drugs is exactly what the fat cats want us to do. It's just like that clip from Boys in the Hood earlier. Kill ourselves and reduce the number of peasants. I wonder how much better people would feel if they put away the drugs and with the money they save buy gasoline and pack picnic boxes and drive pickup trucks to D.C. by the thousands all together in a gigantic moving parade causing traffic so thick they can't get to work. Well, that's how D.C. traffic already is, Cindy. Hate to break it to you. Can you imagine 10,000 pickup trucks at once driving in a circle at Lafayette Park? Maybe 20,000 or more at once? That would make these people feel like they're really doing something to get heard and not be ignored. And, of course, that's something I've been saying for a long time on a more general basis, and that is that people, you know, protest in D.C. has become performance art. You know, you show up on Friday, you have your big protest on Saturday, and you go home on Sunday because you got to be back at work on Monday. And that's how it rolls these days. When the American people get disgusted enough that they come and they stay, that's, you know, that's maybe when change happens. And let's run over and check in with Tracy. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Just, you know, listening to...
I don't know if it's me or if it's you, but your audio is a little low. Let me see if I can boost you some.
Can you hear me better?
Go ahead. Try me again.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah, you're there. You're there. We'll tweak it and make it work.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Is it too low?
No. For some reason, it's coming in low, but I've been experiencing that with Dr. Bill and a couple other Skype calls, too, so it may be something screwed up over here.
Modern technology. Gotta love it.
Wouldn't be the first time.
before I forget, because when I was listening to you and Billable Rick the other day, and Rick kept talking about, you know, us forming our own, like, geek squad, to counteract what, you know, is going on in social media and the Russian trolls and whatnot and so forth. So, again, back to my favorite show, The Good Fight. So just so happens the last few weeks on the show, they're doing just that. There's like this, they started off calling themselves the Resistance, but now they call themselves the Book Club. And it's a bunch of women who, and one of them is like a, you know, expert computer hacker. And she's going after, like she went after, on one episode, she went after a troll farm. And on another episode, they went after, what did they go after? A troll farm. They went after one of Taylor Swift kind of character singer who, I don't choose sides. It's only about the music and stuff like that. That made her finally, you know, should have get off the pot about, you know, support being, you know, her alt-right supporters that have deemed her, you know, the princess of, you know, white supremacy and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, if this could, but the Telltale episode the other day came when they were talking about doing something about disenfranchising voters. And you're like, with a flip of the switch, we can fix all these people, all these black and brown voters who cannot vote because of, you know, voter suppression laws, whatnot, so forth and so on. So there's two characters. There's Audra McDonald, and Christine Baranski. And of course, Christine Baranski is the white woman and Audra McDonald is the black woman. And Christine Baranski is all up in arms. We can't do that. If we do that, we will be, doing what they're doing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Audra McDonald, do you know who Audra McDonald is?
Offhand, no.
Okay, she's a Tony Award-winning actress, singer, amazing.
That explains it. I don't get out to Broadway very often.
Well, neither do I, really, but she, I didn't know this. Shut up, Bob. I didn't know this about her, but, I mean, this is how bad she is. When they did that horrible thing on NBC a few years back on, when they did the Sound of Music Live, she played Mother Superior, and so she sang that song, Climb Every Mountain. So this is how bad this sister is. They casted a black woman to sing, to play a role definitely written for a white woman, to sing Climb Every Mountain.
Okay, I just looked her up. I do recognize her face.
Yeah, she's, you know, I'm pretty, yeah. And when you get a chance, listen, you know, find something with her singing. And because she was in Porgy and Bess, I believe Ragtime, Carousel, I believe. I think that was one of her first.
Yeah, she got a Tony for Carousel, Masterclass, and Ragtime.
Yes. So there you go.
Three Tonys by the time she was 28. So she did. Yeah.
Kimberly.
I was going to say that was the that's a mailman bark if ever I've heard one.
Yeah, that's a mailman bark. Excuse me, Kimba. The mailman doesn't care about you. And that's when she calms down. She gets her blanket and then she buries herself in the blanket and starts to shake it. One day she's going to knock herself out. I kid you not. But anywho.
Not laughing. So, not laughing at, laughing with.
So Arthur McDonald looks at Christine Baranski with all due earnestness. It's like, look, you know, voting rights for you are totally different than voting rights for me. So, you know, while you sit here in your white privilege and say we can't stoop to these levels and, you know, give a whole bunch of people, because she broke it down with how about, you know, about what happened in Georgia, how a group of black senior citizens were turned away when they tried to vote, how they just didn't even, you know, they just regarded over 50,000 people trying to register to vote and all that. She's like, it doesn't mean the same to you as it means to me. So if there's a chance that we can do something to give people back their right to vote, I'm all for it. You know, it's like, we're just giving people what they are entitled to, what they have their God-given right as an American citizen or constitutional right, if, you know, take away church, you know, separation of church and state, but their constitutional right as an American citizen to be able to vote. Because, you know, basically she's telling her, you will never have to worry about being disenfranchised. That's not going to happen to you.
No.
But it'll happen to me. It'll happen to anybody that looks like me. So, you know, how dare you get your hackles up and, you know, and another thing is like, we're at that point where by any means necessary. This is not a fair fight, you know, for these people that keep saying, well, we can wait till November. Everything's going to be fine. Was November 2016 a fair election? So what makes anybody think that 2020 is going to be any different?
That, Tracy, that's my problem with the idea of, well, our best remedy to Donald Trump is to vote him out in 2020.
Right.
We already know the elections are going to be screwed with. Good God, I saw a quote from Trump's campaign manager, Brad Parscale, you know, that dirty little so-and-so, where he declared that God sent Donald Trump to be a savior. He used the word savior for the United States of America.
Awesome.
Now, so that's going to rope in the evangelicals, because they're not going to vote against a savior. They're not going to deny the Messiah now, are they?
Nope.
And, you know, oh, just vote out Donald Trump. I mean, for God's sakes, the man won't even... No collusion. Bullshit. I mean, even the Mueller report, you know, as little as he did, that makes clear that, yeah, they screwed with the election with the express purpose of making Donald Trump president of the United States. Now, why did they do that? Because they're scared of Hillary? That doesn't seem like sufficient motivation.
No,
so,
I don't think that's it. No. Not scared of Hillary. They wanted somebody to do their bidding. So that's why I'm saying, you know, we definitely agree upon that. It's just, how are we going to guarantee fair and a fair and equitable or what have you election in 2020 when we didn't get to say, and then of course, like we, you know, Donald Trump did not win the election. He was not elected president. He was appointed by the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton won the election.
Yep.
But the Electoral College, you know, said, oh no, We won't have the people decide who they want as president. We will decide. So this antiquated racist system made sure that their boy, you know, that their boy got into, you know, the presidency.
Right.
And so now here we are stuck with this crazy, you know, what did I call him? The mendacious mango?
Yes. That's that.
Yeah. So, you know, and so this is, you know, I know about, like you said, about impeachment and stuff like that, but, and it won't go anywhere because it's in the Senate. But even if, you know, we do the investigations and all this, we have, like you said, we have people in power. We got Bill Barr, who just told the Health Judiciary Committee today, fuck you. I'm not talking. I'm not coming in. And, you know, like you said, well, if they find him in contempt, isn't he the one that's going to answer the contempt charge?
Well, he's the one who would be in charge of prosecuting it, unless you appointed a special counsel, which Rod Rosenstein is never going to do, because Bill Barr is not going to declare himself conflicted out. And wow, do I feel awful for saying this. How about that? Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III actually had more of something resembling ethics than the current attorney general. Because the only person who can conflict the attorney general out is the attorney general, with the exception of that office that Billable Rick was talking about last night, the OPE, Office of Professional Ethics. And those guys want to keep their jobs, so they're not going to raise their heads up at, you know, above the hedges and say, oh, well, we think, you know. No. I mean, there are little spots in our civic structure that are exploitable weaknesses, and this is one of them. I don't.
And this is how
democracy dies. Yeah.
You know, Todd and I have conversations at least once or twice a week, and one of the things that he talks about, you know, that we're, this is, you know, and I wouldn't say, you know, people can say this is a bloodless coup, rather. It depends on who you're talking to, because, you know, it may be a bloodless coup for, you know, certain, I call them the melanin challenged. Okay, it's a bloodless coup for them, but not for anybody that, you know, that's a person of color in this country. Meaning a young brother shot in the street, or, you know, parents being separated from their children and being thrown in jail. So,
yeah, by the way, right, Agnes sent me a breaking-ish story a few minutes ago. We've killed another kid in our one of our concentration camps.
Another one?
Yeah, a 16-year-old Guatemalan boy was sent to a... Hey, you remember when all the booger eaters and the tea baggers and stuff were getting all upset about blue helmets crossing the Rio Grande, and they were just sure that Obama was turning worn out Walmarts into FEMA re-education camps where their urine colored snake flags were going to be taken away from them and their guns. Remember that? Well. Turns out Obama didn't do that, but this 16-year-old Guatemalan boy was sent to a repurposed Walmart in Texas that was...
Jimba, I'm going to kill you.
Now.
And I just said that on national radio. I am not going to kill you. Go on, hush.
Oh, I heard little claws clicking on the flooring. She's despondent and dejected and disgusted. But now they call this they call this tumble down Walmart the Southwest Key Casa Padre. And it's meant to house it's a concentration camp for over 1,000 immigrant children. And since it's a statement issued by the Department of Health and Human Services, this is a lie. No health concerns were observed by clinicians with U.S. Customs and Border Protection when CBP facilitated the transfer of the minor to the shelter. Upon arrival to the shelter, the minor did not note any health concerns. Yeah, because I'm sure they've got they've got people who speak K'iche Mayan there. No. But the following morning, employees noticed that the boy was sick with a fever and chills and a headache. And they took him to a nearby hospital where he got treatment. And then they brought him back to the concentration camp, and he didn't get better. And then on April 22nd, they gave him an ambulance ride to a different hospital. Then they transported him to a children's hospital in Corpus Christi. And then they made sure that his brother and people from the Guatemalan consul could visit him. And then he died.
All right.
The Guatemalan Ministry of Foreign Affairs said he had developed a severe infection in the frontal lobe that showed no improvement even after a surgical intervention to stabilize the pressure inside the head area. Jesus God.
So much for that blood was true, huh, dear Bob?
Yeah, it's not so bloodless. No.
Not so bloodless.
You know, that goes hand in hand with this. I don't know if you heard Nidia when she called talking about the, you know, black guys in West Virginia being referred to drug rehab for smoking weed.
For marijuana.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that.
Well, I mentioned the fentanyl smelling like something, and our buddy Scary Jerry wrote in and said, smells like marshmallows, fentanyl. Heroin's disappeared around here. It's all about Mexican fentanyl now. Funny thing about herb is two things. Illegal CBD flower is now legal nationwide, and it's amazing. Well, it's legal-ish. You can still get your ass busted for a felony at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport because their dogs are still alerting on CBD because it has some micromolecular level of THC still in it. Yeah. But Scary Jerry goes on and says, busting men of color is the greatest criminal justice hustle ever. You can still get a year's probation in good old Georgia for a roach. And this is still incarceration nation. $300 plus court costs and then drug court and testing and supervision. It's a hell of a hustle, Bob, a hell of a hustle. The fucked up thing is that a bag of weed is the most health care a lot of people in this country can even afford, especially if they're coming off meth or fentanyl or coke or alcohol. We're fucked right now. The Republicans did it, and the Democrats are still sitting on their hands. You know, not to be disagreeable for the sake of being disagreeable, but we've only got one House of Congress. If the American people want anything done, they've got to give us both houses of Congress, and they've got to give us a president to work with. That's the only way this works. Just for the sake of imagination, try to visualize an America in 1932 that reelects Herbert Hoover. Imagine an America going through the Great Depression with a Republican Congress and a Republican president who doesn't give a flying fuck. Imagine giving another term to a guy who had African-American men chained together working on a levee as the floodwaters rose along the Mississippi River. Yeah, and those were free African-American men.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Bloodless coup. No, not so much.
Not so much. I mean, it's just, you know, we're at that point, and, you know, the thing that frightens, I don't know if the right word is frightens or just pisses me the fuck off. It's just the fact that, you know, there's this sense of you know, overwhelming dread and hopelessness, and old girl who called earlier, you know, when she was talking about the epidemic of what's happening, you know, people being bored and, you know, hopeless, and it's like they're using drugs as an escape. What's happening in West Virginia is no different than what's happening in South Central.
No, but and you know what? There's that one passage from the clip that I played for Boys in the Hood where he said, you know, rock didn't become a problem till it showed up in Iowa.
Exactly. Well, rock is just like the AIDS epidemic. It didn't become a problem until white people started, you know, straight white people and rich people started getting AIDS.
Oh, then, we've definitely got to do something about this. This is terrible.
Now we've got to do something about it because there's a problem.
And nobody who's paying attention to this really disagrees. And I was afraid that I might have been blowing past that line. It was not intentional. But because, you know, we didn't have an opioid problem until white folks had an opioid problem. We didn't have a heroin problem until white folks had a heroin problem. And that is over 100 years old in this region because morphine and heroin even ran wild in the black portions of the coal camps.
Yes. I mean, like how I was talking about, you know, some of my favorite movies back in the day were, you know, Come Back Charleston Blue and you know, Cotton Comes to Harlem. Cotton Comes to Harlem wasn't really about drugs. But there were, you know, there was different issues about drugs. But, you know, Come Back Charleston Blue and Superfly and all these other things, you know, it was about heroin. And how, you know, because back in the day in the 60s, 70s, and most of these were brothers coming back from, you know, Vietnam, you know, they were hooked on heroin. So you got a whole bunch of black folks and brown folks messing with heroin. And then they start, I don't know when the transition went from, you know, black people and brown people, you know, dealing with heroin till we eased into crack, maybe because crack was easier, you know, crack was definitely easier to get. But, you know, look what happened to Billie Holiday. I mean, she was in and out of drugs, rehabs, and all this sort of stuff because of what? Heroin. You know, it's always been around, but it was only the only black people were messing with it. And then, like you said, when it becomes a problem, when it goes into middle-class America and you know, kids in the suburbs are messing with it, then it becomes a problem.
And if I may, and I recognize the inherent danger in me doing this, so forgive me in advance, that's why you can sneak a few million hydrocodones into southern West Virginia and central Appalachia generally, because that ain't middle-class America. What you said a little bit ago is very, very true. It's the rural, poverty-stricken equivalent of South Central.
Mm-hmm.
Blasted, exploited, run over, left to die, and you know, because it didn't become the opioid crisis didn't become a big deal until the last 6 years or so, when it got into the middle class white America. But the hillbilly, but the poor white hillbillies were dropping like goddamn flies for a decade before.
Yep. Absolutely. So. There is, like, you know, so it's like it doesn't become a problem until the right people.
Yeah.
until it starts to affect them. And, you know, and it's you know, it just, and I've been saying this for, you know, long even before I even, you know, knew who you were, because I lived in South Central in the 80s during the middle of the crack war. I mean, there was an alley behind my mom's house, and it was not uncommon to see a dead body from, you know, well, now that we know, it's, you know, because of the Grim Sleeper, you know, all these women that were murdered and nobody, you know, because, you know, no humans, you know, that's what they were put on the police report, NHI, no humans involved, because they were, quote unquote, you know, crackheads, chickenheads, strawberries. So, you know, it didn't matter because no humans involved. So So you have all these people dying and, you know, family. Look, this is how bad the crack epidemic was back in the day, Bob. My grandmother, the woman that I, and, you know, I've told you guys a story about my grandmother got hooked on crack.
Oh, shit.
Okay. My grandmother, she got it. She finally got herself together. Before a few years, she was fucking with crack. Mm-hmm. My mom's house got firebombed because my cousin and my aunt were supposed to be selling, you know, selling crack. But instead of selling it, they were using it. And so since they didn't have shit, they came out. My mom lost two cars and firebombed because, you know.
Does this explain why? Does this explain why your mom is in North Carolina now?
No. As a matter of fact, my mother moved to North Carolina because my stepfather was, you know, she was just underwater in her, you know, underwater with her house. And my brother's like, you know what? Stop. You're killing yourself trying to keep a house that ain't worth shit. And my brother owned his home in North Carolina and he was about to go overseas. And didn't want to worry about, you know, dealing with, you know, management companies and all that. So her and my baby brother moved to North Carolina and never looked back. They got rid of what they could get rid of. They sold what they could, everything else. They just gave away. She packed up her shit and she left California in 1999 and never looked back.
Let me ask you for a from the standpoint of perspective, because I am California clueless. Did the gentrification that Lawrence Fishburne was talking about in Boys in the Hood, did it proceed? Did it come into? I mean,
yes. Now, see, when all this started happening, like, you know, houses, you know, money for your homes and stuff like this. What was starting to happen was because of the crack epidemic and stuff like that. People started, you know, we had our own black flight. So people started moving out to, like, Palmdale, Lancaster, Rancho Cucamonga, Fontana, or better yet, known as Fontucky.
Really now?
Started moving. Yes, Fontucky. And they started leaving, you know, the hood. And because the houses were cheaper, and they figured if they got away from these neighborhoods, their lives would be better. Hell, even Snoop Dogg, I believe, lives in Chino. Okay? He got the fuck out, you know? So we had, you know, so all the, you know, then we had the Hispanic people move into, you know, what was basically black spaces like Watts, Compton, South Central. There's more, probably at this point in time, there's probably more Hispanic people in South Central than there are black people. I mean, you drive down Central Avenue and you're going to see Conestadia, Lavendaria. I mean, seriously, it's definitely changed. But what happened was all these black people were moving. And then the developers really didn't start coming in, really. But what was happening is people were buying up houses and, you know, renting to Hispanic people. And, or, you know, so that was happening. But the gentrification really started. And I don't really remember what year Boys in the Hood was filmed.
Isn't that about 95?
About 95. So it was after Rodney King. So, or was it? Yeah, Rodney King, 94? Who was Rodney King? Lord Jesus. No, Rodney King was in 92. The earthquake was in 94. I always get them mixed up. So,
wait a minute. Stop.
Wait.
Rodney King was 92. The earthquake was 94. It's the I always get them mixed up that makes it art, Tracy. That's why you got a cowbell. Earthquake, you know, brutal police beating, hard to tell the difference.
I get the years mixed up because it's like, so I'm like,
no, well, we're geezers now. We're geezers now, Tracy. It happens to us.
Yeah, so it's 92, 94, whenever. So, yeah, because that's what I was. I moved out of L.A. in time. That's what it was. So the uprising was in April of 92. We moved. Alex and I had just moved to the Valley in February of 92. So, I missed the uprising, but I was in the Valley for the earthquake. But, it, you know, so as a matter of fact, I narrowly missed the uprising, to tell you the truth. I don't know if I ever told you guys the story, but the day of the verdict, and this was before, you know, this was before cell phones. I mean, people had cell phones, but it was those big old bricks, so not everybody had cell phones, but people had pagers. Alex was still going to school in L.A., and I didn't have a car. I had to catch the bus. So when I was getting ready to leave, they were about to announce the verdict, but I had to go. So I had to, it was like two buses, the one that got you out the valley, and then the bus that I had to, the bus that got you from the valley to L.A., and then there was the bus that I caught from once I got to L.A. When I got to L.A., by the time I got to L.A., the verdicts had come in, and because the brother was on the, seriously, on the corner, listened to a transistor radio, like, you know, until he's like, oh, dude, you know, not guilty. I'm like, ain't this some shit? So I go pick up my son, which is, he was on Bergen and Western. And if you know, a few blocks down was where the epicenter, where the, what was his name? Reginald Denny got, you know, got snatched out of his truck and all that. And I was just like blocks away from there. But, that, you know, so I went and picked up Alex. We on the bus. And well, we were talking to my, his school, his teacher, and we're on the, and we're like, this is some ridiculous, this is crazy. And I'm like, you know, so I'm like, well, let me get out of here. So I get on the bus and going down Western, and my mom lived by USC, and I was going to ride off the, you know, the bus, and I was going to stop, and but my mom's house, I'm like, no, she's probably not even home yet, because again, can't call or check if she's at home. So I stayed on the bus, and I was about to, getting ready to pass First AME, which is one of the, you know, the bigger black churches in L.A. And they were and actually they were having a prayer vigil. And I was going to get off the bus. And I'm like, no. Somebody told me, no, stay on the bus. So I'm on the bus. We get out of L.A. We get into the valley, and I turn on the news. By the time I got back into the valley, L.A. was on fire. And, of course, I'm freaked out because, you know, my family. I'm the only one in my family at the time that lived in the valley. Everybody else lived in L.A. And I couldn't get a hold of anybody because the phone lines were down. I'm sitting here and I'm watching, you know, my neighborhood up in flames. And I can't get a hold of my mother. I can't get a hold of my grandmother. I can't get a hold of anybody. And it was probably the most terrifying thing that I have ever gone through. So it's just like, you know, so that was my experience. And so, and what, how I remember when it was is because that the following day was Alex's fourth birthday. And because LA was on lockdown, what is it not quarantine, lockdown? What is it?
Martial law.
Not martial law. When you can't go out a certain time of the day.
Curfew.
Thank you. Curfew. So nobody could come out to. I couldn't go into L.A. because I didn't have a car, and you know all the buses. So I was on. I was like on one of the last buses out of L.A. into the valley. So I couldn't get out. They couldn't come in. You know, they couldn't leave. It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. But back to the question about, you know, the gentrification after. The uprising, that is started. That's basically when it all started. When people started leaving, when people started, you know, and arms developers started swooping in and buying distressed properties, and you know, and charging ridiculous amounts of rent. But it kind of stalled, and then later on, in the last 10 years, like you know, what's going on? Like there's this area called Leimert Park. There's Leimert Park. There's Baldwin Hills. These were all white enclaves. And, you know, we had the big white flight. Now, because these are, you know, gorgeous homes, bungalows, you know, Spanish stucco and all these, all of a sudden now all these houses are, white people are moving back in. And who did you, what did you say? When you see white people walking dogs.
When you see, yeah. That was from Ron.
That's when you know. You know, and that's what's happening. You know, so all these, you know, so all these affordable housing and all this is gone. It is gone, and it's gotten even worse now that, like, especially like in Inglewood, where they're building, you know, finishing up the NFL stadium for the Rams and the Chargers, people's rents aren't just doubling, Bob, they're tripling. And because when we had that initiative in November of 2016, 2018, to do something, not just citywide, but statewide rent control. It got defeated in the polls because the developers were like putting on these horrible ads and lying and scaring people into not voting for it. So now we got, you know, people being forced out of their homes because greed. Gotta love capitalism, Bob. Gotta love it.
Oh, we just got a note in from Lady B. Mm-hmm. She says, say hi to Tracy for her. So, hey, Tracy, from Lady B. You know how some people praised Bryan Cranston's character, by the way, Walter White, on Breaking Bad for making and selling meth because he was doing whatever it took to make sure his wife and kids would be taken care of? How come nobody ever had that type of praise for black folks in the 70s and 80s? Blacks couldn't land the same types of jobs millions of whites did, the ones that launched them into the middle class, therefore better preparing their kids for a better future. Now you see weed, a drug some blacks have spent 10 years or more in prison for growing and selling, hell, smoking, over, being freely discussed by white people as a business opportunity on CNBC. See, that's where I have to use my Richard Pryor white guy voice. Business opportunity. Hypocrisy, says Lady B, is a safe space for the mind. Have a good night. And like she said, say hey to Tracy for her. And there's a monumental double standard. And it's...
Well, I have brought this up before, too, about, you know, how, like you said, you know, how Walter White, well, fuck, Joe Kennedy, when he was a fucking bootlegger. And look at how much wealth his family has.
Well, and maybe...
But when the brother's on the corner...
Yeah, no, different story.
Selling crack. Right. I mean, you know, I'm not justifying, you know.
No. I get that. And there's, you know, there's a larger issue here. I know we're all about, and one of the things that I find most odious about the current approach to cannabis legalization is that it was criminalized on a federal, it was a federal decision to criminalize it. It needs to be a federal decision to legalize it, not decriminalize it, legalize it. And I say that because right now we have a problem because whether it's California, Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts, whomever, it's being done under the guise of that most odious of phrases, states' rights. And we need a national solution to this. And the other national, the reason it needs to be a national solution is we need a national legalization of cannabis. And then alongside that, there needs to be another part of the statute that says, and henceforward, every last cannabis conviction for anybody living or dead it be and is hereby expunged as though it never existed.
Exactly.
We need to pull a big old, you know, because I love to get all Latin and Roman and shit. We need to pull a big old damnatio memoriae on the idea of convictions of people for possession, use, selling, manufacturing, growing cannabis.
Well,
not just an idea.
You know, classic example for me. I have fibromyalgia and I have a myriad of health issues. And the only thing that would help me would be weed. I live in California. I should be able to smoke weed, right? Because, you know, even before it became legal recreationally, it was for medicinal purposes. But because I drive a cab and we get pee tested, I can't. And like you say, even if I've only smoked one joint 2 weeks ago, and that was all I it's going to still be in my system 30 days later.
And then your life's over.
And then I can't drive a cab anymore.
And because we're approaching it from the standpoint of states' rights, everybody gets to treat it differently. And everybody gets to treat the outcomes differently. Here's a fascinating, and we got to roll out of here because we're past the top of the hour. Subject line, and this is from Cindy. Rodney King riot. Sad to have to name a riot after him, isn't it? It's just an anchor to label an event. No offense to his family. That day, we had packed up into a Ryder truck all of our belongings and were leaving L.A. We were in San Pedro, south of South Central. Steve and I drove in the truck, and we put our two teenage sons on board the bus to go to Central L.A. and wait for the next bus to Las Vegas and points beyond. We were going to South Dakota. We didn't know about the riot because our radios and TVs were packed away in the truck. We learned about it after the kids left. We were afraid for them, but everyone managed without being hurt. Long story, but then this is... Here's the kicker. Point was, I was blocks away from Tracy that very day.
What?
Yeah, isn't that something?
Wow.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's a huge wow. Well, thank you for letting me... I don't think it's right to say wax nostalgic about uprising. And, you know, and just what happened, but it gives a perspective. And,
yeah.
You know, like you said, we're at that point, you know, and, you know, and I'm going to try to make this a quick cut. I know you got to go. But, and, you know, like you said, nothing different from the hillbilly in Appalachia to my brothers and sisters in South Central about how we are treated in this and regarded in this country. How for never. At least most of my brothers and sisters, I mean, if not all, in South Central realize what we have to do as far as getting justice and voting people out and stuff like that. I just wish my homies and my brothers and sisters in Appalachia would stop voting against their own self-interest and get rid of people like the turtle and all these other assholes who could give a flying fuck about these people, but they keep bullying them in anyway. So that is the difference between poor people, poor black and brown folks mostly, and what's happening in your neck of the woods.
And you know what? This is probably going to come across as monumentally offensive, so I will pre-apologize again because it's going to smell like appropriation. Maybe we need a second decade of the 21st century remake of Boys in the Hood.
Yeah.
And maybe it needs to be called Boys in the Holler.
Yep. There needs to be something. There is something, because I know everybody's there's not a Trump supporter and stuff, and maybe there's some people, there's some good people. I mean, of course there aren't because I talk to you. But there's still those people that are still on the fence.
They're still full on Trumpansies. I mean, don't kid yourself.
They're the Trumpansies.
There's only one problem with making Boys in the Holler. How are you going to find anybody who is going to? I mean, Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah.
What was he, 12? You know.
he's just
like a baby.
He's a baby.
But you know, flannel shirt, overalls. There we go.
Jerry curl.
Not for white folks, but you know.
We get some people with Drew Froze. What am I going to say? I
don't know. Oh well, you know, once upon a time, before my children turned it all white and made it fall out. I had Peter Frampton hair.
See, I want pictures.
I don't think any exist. But it was down past my shoulders. I was exactly 20 years old, and all I had to do was wash it and shake it like a wet dog, and it hung down in ringlets and looked like, the face wasn't, but the hair was straight off of Frampton Comes Alive. No processing, no chemicals, no nothing. So.
See, that's what I'm talking about. Like I said, that's how. But anyway, I know you got to go. But you know, we're going to come up with a solution to get some of the people in your neck of the woods to stop. You know, I don't know if that'll ever happen.
Oh,
but
no. I mean, we exist. I mean, you've
got enough of you.
No, you would absolutely love to go and hang out in Fayetteville. But the problem is, a lot of the folks, and you know, The reason Fayetteville is so cool is because people who were tired of being where they were came here and decided to make a better world and a better life. And it just hasn't expanded enough.
Yeah.
I mean, people...
Like, you know, Flagstaff in Arizona, Austin in Texas, you know.
Yeah, it's like I said, little Fayetteville.
I want to move to these places. It's like, but they're still in, pick the state, Georgia. They're still in Texas. They're still in West Virginia. You're surrounded. So it's like, no.
No, and, like, and you're
I'll come hang out and visit. I love visiting, but I got to get my ass back home.
No, I believe you me. I understand. And as weird as it may sound, Tracy, it happens to me, too. I love to go to big cities and visit, but I got to get my ass back to the hills. That's why it's so important to me to stop destroying them.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, on that note, love it. Love you. Kisses. I'm as I was talking to you, I get to use my food processor because I cut up everything and I'm making.
I've been hearing some chopping going on, yeah. And I haven't ruined dinner in the Pacific time zone, so yay me.
No, yay Bob. So yeah, everything is ready to go. I cut up the onions, I cut up the bell pepper, I'm about to cut up the celery. So you have helped me process my dinner.
And you know, it's so hard to end these conversations because now we're into food porn. I was walking through the grocery store today, Tracy, and you know how I've been brining, you know, ribs and brining pork loins and brining briskets. I walked past this big old beautiful slab of salmon, and I thought, what if I seasoned the bejesus out of that and brined that and slow smoked it?
Things that make you go, Well, you could always try that recipe that I sent you the other day.
Yeah.
I don't use salmon because Jan doesn't like salmon, so I made it with tilapia. Oh, it was so good.
Oh, I bet
but
it was.
I was thinking about you when I made, you know, with the salmon because it was, you know, the foil packets, so you could put it on the grill because you could either do it on the grill or in the oven.
Agnes loves her some salmon, and, you know, the trick.
You have to try that recipe. You have to try that recipe.
I will.
You must.
That might even be a good good anniversary weekend dinner. I'll give that some thought.
Yeah.
Tracy, have yourself a wonderful evening,
dear.
Oh
my God. You have a wonderful. Good night, my love.
All right. See you soon. Later. Bye now. And so we're done, and we will find ourselves at Friday on the front porch trying to raise $325. So thank you very kindly to Cindy and to Charlie for jumping in this evening. Thank you very kindly indeed. It helps more than you know. And thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program. Thanks to all of you who keep the program going for everybody else. Thank you. Thank you ever so... Wait, let me check here. I may have missed something. Hold on. If I miss a thank you, I hate myself later. Because I get wrapped up in conversations and things kind of fly by me and so forth. Thank you, Brian. I knew I missed one. Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Cindy, and thank you, Charlie. What that boils down to is we've only got 100 to finish the evening, so that means 300 tomorrow night. Thanks so very much indeed. And thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky earlier. Thanks to Steve from Georgia Stan. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you very, very, very forever much to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.